This is an ESO and Dude Letter production. Welcome to a big episode 3 of Mission Briefing. While, as you guys heard last week, we all really like From Russia with Love, Goldfinger, I think, is probably one of the biggest titles in the Bond archive, where most of the stakes are set and probably the most movies emulate the formula. So please, enjoy. Welcome to Mission Briefing.
Here, DragonCon Video Gaming Track, we have lots of stars. Star Wars The Old Republic, Star Trek, Star Citizen, Starcraft,
Minecraft, World of Warcraft, World of Tanks, World of Planes, World of Ships, Pirate Ships, Bridge Airships, Spaceships, Space Quest, Adventure Quest, MetQuest, EverQuest, EverQuest 2, Mass Effect 2, Mass Effect 3, Ultima 3, Ultima Online, Anarchy Online, World of Rings Online, EVE Online, City Online, City of Villains, City of Titans, City of Heroes, Vanguard, Saga of Heroes, Hero Smash, Heroes of the Storm, League of Heroes, League of Legends, Kingdoms of Legend, Age of Kingdoms, Age of Conan, Age of Evolution, Dragon Age, Dragon's Pride.
I think you get the idea.
Welcome to Mission Briefing, Myopia's sister podcast, where we talk this week about Goldfinger as we go through all the Bond movies. This week we're on number 3, 1964's Goldfinger. But before we get too far into this, I realize, to my embarrassment, we skipped a person on this podcast. And Dr. No, me, Matt, Mark, and John talked about our kind of one-on-one experience with Bond. And we didn't get a chance to talk to our fifth member, Thomas. And so I was hoping, Thomas, you could tell us a little bit about how you got into Bond and what you remember about learning early Bond stuff.
So I guess when I was a kid, probably about 10 or 11, a friend of my parents ended up giving me the VHS GoldenEye, which I probably burned the magnetic strip off watching so much. And then from there, I remember when Tomorrow Never Dies went out, and I am still to this day not sure how I got my parents to let me see that movie in theaters like 4 or 5 times, but they did, and I got friends to go with me, and I had better friends than I thought I did as a kid. But I have not missed a Bond movie since then, and I remember just loving when Spike started doing the Christmas Bond marathons at the Thanksgiving. They just thought up reasons to do Bond marathons, and it was kind of how I caught up on all of them.
Didn't TNT do it initially?
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
I forget which Turner station it was, but you're right. I mean, I think it ultimately just goes around the horn, and every time the license comes up, the next station does it.
I seem to just remember it being on Spike or whatever.
Spike definitely did.
Yeah,
Spike. Not to derail your intro.
No.
I'm so sorry.
I'm sure TNT did it as well. I just remember, like, you know, sitting down through Spike and going, oh, I'm going to watch this. And then somehow over time I managed to compile the DVD collection, and I've sat down and watched each of them in its entirety without commercials, unedited. And I don't know. I do love them all. I mean, you know, George Lazenby can take a long walk off a short pier, but the rest of them have their enjoyable bits. Some of them are absolutely ridiculously silly, but I still enjoy that as well because it's just a way to watch Bond.
I'm not going to argue with you here. So we should get into this, but like is tradition, before anyone knows what the actual plot is, we start with a cold open, which has tangential related material. So where are we? Who wants to start this? Bond is in a Latin, or I guess South American country.
South American. Yeah. Did they ever explicitly say he's in South America?
No. But I want to say there was a sign in the back of wherever he ends up that says, like, bodega, which...
Hey.
My Spanish is not quite up there, but I'm pretty sure that's Hispanic.
Yeah. It is.
Nailed it.
And then he heads to Miami, which, if that's the nearest American port...
I mean, it could be Cuba. Like, almost all the Bond movies in this era started in Cuba or around Cuba. And so Bond... Well, it's actually kind of weird. Bond is observing something, right? What happens? Like,
it was very unclear, honestly.
Well, honestly, no. So I went and looked into this. It's like, so you're talking about what he observed in Miami or what he was doing in
at the cold open.
Yeah, oh, at the cold open. So basically, he sneaks in and blows up.
He puts plastique on a bunch of barrels of generic nitro.
Yeah. And as you do.
He basically creates a fertilizer bomb and it goes boom. Like,
he mentions actually to the guy, because after the place goes up in smoke, he walks into this bar, sits down at the bar. I'm assuming he orders a drink. And he's talking to the guy next to him kind of under his breath, who I'm guessing is his contact. And Bond says, so-and-so won't be selling bananas laced with heroin anymore.
Oh, I totally missed that.
So it was a drug takedown.
Okay, that.
Which harkens forward to the 80s movies where they were all about the drugs.
The vague drug trade.
Yeah.
So, that vague drug trade.
This is probably the first time we see Bond just doing normal spy stuff, if blowing things up is normal.
Well, I mean, this is
but
just...
it's not global consequences.
Stay tuned, live and let die.
God, well, yeah.
Bless you.
Yeah.
Well, and it's so straight Cold War stuff. It's like, well, the CIA is going to interrupt this vague drug trade in Colombia. The MI5 is just doing it in Cuba or place X, right? And my favorite part of this whole scene is his, you know, like most cliched Hispanic contact you can imagine goes, they'll be looking for you. You should not go, or you shouldn't stay in your hotel room tonight. And he goes, I have one thing I have to do first.
But which is awesome. But what I think one of the greatest things that it is the quintessential kind of like, you know, cementing, like, you know, third movie, we already have Bond is king of cool. But, you know, getting up there, you know, bombing it, then jumping down off the wall, zipping out of his dry suit. And there he is in a white suit. Perfectly
tuxedo,
pressed, not a crease, the tuxedo, not a crease or fold in it, and he's good to go. Like, you know.
Well, and it's
straight in his tie.
Well, and exactly. It's a precursor to what Roger Moore and Pierce Brosnan will be. Like, it's just, I don't want to say it's a shame, but it's just, it's perfect spycraft, right? And he just takes it off, lights a cigarette as the explosions happen behind him, and he's so, like, kind of, he's not nonplussed, but he's like, my word, an explosion.
It was actually very funny watching his facial expression when the bomb actually goes off. He's just like, oh, something happened.
As though he was like, well, the fuse was supposed to be 3 seconds shorter, but my word, I guess it worked at least.
I'll have a word with Q.
Right. There's a lot of I'll have a word with Q in this movie, actually, which is kind of weird.
And just as kind of a nonsensical segue, he goes and tries to make out with the belly dancer girl at the bar, and she's waiting for him. They obviously know each other, and he sees someone sneaking up behind him,
reflected in
her eyes, and fights him, and then in probably one of the more iconic deaths, throws the guy into the full bathtub and throws the toaster in there. The hair dryer.
The desk fan, yes.
Desk fan, whatever. He throws the minor appliance.
Was that effect for that desk fan electrocution was great. It was like big red light.
Yeah. As low there was a light bulb in the bottom of the tub. It was amazing.
Almost, yeah.
And with that, Bond leaves generic Latin American country. Mm-hmm. And we get our Bond sequence, right? Our theme song. Like From Russia With Love, it is projected on women, but this one... Goldfinger, brace yourself. The women are covered in gold paint, right?
Yeah. I think this one really sets the tone for the future Bond intros.
It's also the first Bond intro with the title theme in the title opening. Yeah. Technically Dr. No is the title theme, you know, but still.
And From Russia With Love almost did it, except they did an instrumental rather than the,
the full song. Which we hear in
And speaking of this song...
Is, Shirley Bassey.
I mean, definitely one of the defining songs of the series. I mean, if there's one you remember, it's going to be this, probably.
Well, and it's not only a good song, it's just, it's so fantastic. Considering, again, Bond makes a joke at the expense of the Beatles later on, right? This is, it's like listening to the Beatles without earmuff song. Like, it's that. And so this is really a lounge song. Like, this is the kind of music you imagine that Bond actually seeks out if he's in a Bond, like... in a bar, dealing with someone, right? That's why I like it. It works perfectly.
Very 60s.
Mm-hmm. Very 60s. Yeah. But it's Rat Pack 60s. It's not Beatles.
Strong horn theme. I loved it. It was just, you know.
But it's interesting because, again, he makes a Beatles joke in 1964, which is crazy because that's very early in the Beatles. Mm-hmm. But it just lets you know that. Well, it's all the more ironic then when Roger Moore uses Live and Let Die, but that's another story for another day. And so on these women wearing, like, painted gold, wearing gold bikinis, you see this projection of scenes from not only this movie, but from Russia With Love, because we see him with the hat on shooting at the helicopter a couple times. And you really get, like Matt was saying, this is the precursor to all of them, because this is the first time where we have the kind of audible song in it. But we have the this weird projection, like this music video almost for the song, which is great.
I'll be curious to see what the next movies is, whether or not they go beyond just the shots of the movie and the silhouetted women, or
if they start to take it in the more experimental direction, I guess you would say. It's Thunderball, right, is the next
yeah.
one?
Yeah,
Thunderball is next.
And yeah. I actually almost remember the Thunderball sequence, now that I'm thinking about it. But.
Mm. Ooh.
Mm.
Saucy.
But I'd
save
say,
that for next time.
Yeah. I was going to say. But ultimately, I'd say this is actually kind of an interesting one, just because, it's the first, but B, if it ended up in a movie today, other than the fact that there's not dripping CGI octopi, which was weird.
Yes.
Yeah, this one feels actually fairly modern, you know, considering it's 50 years ago.
And I think, as you mentioned during the movie, it's worth mentioning, we watched this on Blu-ray, and the textures and definition on the gold-painted woman in the title were just, they were really good.
It's incredible. Like, this movie is shockingly beautiful to look at. It's something that I miss, like the new, you know, we'll get to actual practical effects versus CGI. This movie was, what, did you say $2
million?
$3 million to make. And so it's all practical effects. There's some really bad model work. We'll get to the little models that they
but
use.
To be fair, there's also some very good
incredible
model work.
There yeah. is. And some bad rear projection and some great rear projection. So this sequence is so fundamental and so simple. And yet it feels really good. It looks good.
Well, actually, we were looking up some of the fun little facts and trivia. And was that this is Spielberg's favorite Bond film, and this was Fellini. Like, Fellini commented that this is the type of movie that moves cinema forward. Like, he liked this as well, which I think, speaking from that, is kind of like
something.
You're like, oh, wow.
Well, and it's we'll get to it, but if you can think of a Bond cliche, it's in this movie, and it's not cliched yet. This is like the OG Bond movie almost, much more so in some ways than Dr. No, which is a great film. We've talked about it. But if it wasn't, if you didn't call him James Bond, it could be almost any movie.
Speaking of, we should have named our podcast Straight Out of Q Branch.
Yeah, I know. We thought about it. It's one of those things that now that we're three episodes in, we're like, it could have been Straight Out of Q Branch, like Straight Out of Compton. That's topical. But before we get further, Matt, now that we're through the cold open and the musical number, you need to give us the plot of this movie.
So, oh god, I had it pulled up and everything, I was cued, but I got it now. So, the powerful tycoon, Auric Goldfinger, has initiated Operation Grand Slam, a cataclysmic scheme to raid Fort Knox and obliterate the world economy. James Bond, armed with his specifically equipped Aston Martin, must stop the plan by overcoming several outrageous adversaries. First, there's Oddjob, the mute servant who kills at the toss of a lethal hat. Next, the beautiful Jill Masterson, who gives a new meaning to the phrase, quote, golden girl. And finally, sexy pilot Pussy Galore, whose romantic feelings for Bond complicate her involvement in Goldfinger's high-flying scheme.
That's the worst thing I've ever heard. Do you get that from Wikipedia?
IMDb.
Wow.
I liked it, actually.
No, it's good. It reads like the back of like a VHS copy.
Yep.
I'm impressed. I don't even know what to make of that. It's kind of impressive.
Yeah,
we should get through this. Goddamn. So we reopen on Bond after the credit sequence in Miami, Florida. We get this flyover where he's at the Fontainebleau.
Yep.
Right, which is this beautiful resort hotel right on the beach.
Very swanky.
Very swanky. And Bond, from all we can tell, is effectively on vacation. But we don't get much information while he's there. He's just there. And then all of a sudden, Felix Leiter shows up around the pool. And all the ladies are like, ooh, it's Felix Leiter. And they're checking him out, but we don't know why. Right? Because all the women turn over and like are watching him walk by. And just a guy in a gray flannel suit.
And he does not look particularly suave. Of all the people at this resort.
Can we just assume that that Felix Leiter is the James Bond of the CIA? And he has his own little mission.
Not this Felix Leiter. This Felix Leiter was a bit schmucky.
This Felix Leiter might be the worst we've seen so far.
Well, this guy hangs around for a while, doesn't he?
I think he does, and it's a shame because he's no good. Well, I mean,
he was fine.
He was fine,
but like the KFC scene. I mean, we'll get to all of this.
Oh, oh my goodness! Original recipe.
Yeah, his name is Sec Linder, or Keck Linder. I don't know. CEC Linder.
Okay,
fine. But yeah, he's. He's just such a wet noodle of a character in this movie. Considering that 2 years before he was in Lolita, and like, he just does nothing. And this might be his only Bond movie, in fact. I'm looking.
Who was he in Lolita?
He was the physician.
I'd have to watch it again.
I
don't have to, though, I mean.
Yeah, no, I don't. You do.
Yeah, this might be his only Bond movie. But he's just this weird wet noodle of a character. He's uncharismatic. He just kind of wanders through the scene, but he gives Bond his mission, kind of. He's like, see that guy over there? You mean the fat man? Yeah, the fat guy wearing the terry towel. So apparently 1964 was a big year for terry cloth.
Oh yeah.
Bond is wearing
a jumper, a terry cloth jumper.
That was fashionable. I would take one of those today.
I would wear it right now. It's collared.
Do you know how much more comfortable that would be than my current outfit? Like orders of magnitude.
I am unwilling to shave my legs to make that happen.
Oh my god, it was the shortest shorts on those jumpers. Like, I don't know if he was wearing like boxers or swim trunks underneath. Probably the swim trunks. He was being massaged in at the top by Dink. The woman's name was Dink.
Was
right?
it?
Yes, because it, remember when whatever name is
when Lily Masterson dies, and he calls up Felix, goes, the girl's dead. Dink?
No, another one.
No, the other one. No, keep track.
I mean, it just, you just get this feeling that Bond is, he's had to call Felix before when he's been in the States.
He's had a few dead women in hotel rooms.
Yeah, so we're introduced to Bond wearing swim trunks, being massaged by a woman named Dink in a sun chair, right? In a pool chair.
He's relaxing.
And then all of a sudden Felix comes up and goes, James? And he goes, hey, Felix! And then the woman stands up and goes, can I help you or something? And she goes, it's man talk. And smacks her on the butt, and then she walks.
Oh, the 60s.
This might be the most misogynistic Bond.
Just by that one line, really.
Well, and then he almost rapes Pussy Galore.
Well, yeah.
Well, I mean, he does rape Pussy Galore.
Very aggressive, yeah.
He was definitely very aggressive.
Yeah.
With an unwilling participant. Yeah.
At least initially, I mean.
I guess that's a definition of rape, isn't it?
Yeah.
Bond is so masculine, he converts everyone to his side.
Yeah, we'll get into that.
Yeah, we'll get into that.
I don't like the connotations of that phrase.
Yeah. So, Felix says, watch Auric Goldfinger. He's this big German guy who wears gold-colored things, and Bond comes across him cheating at bridge.
Gin.
Thank you. And he's trying to figure out why Goldfinger is doing so well, and he walks up to Goldfinger's room, taking a key off the maid, opening the door, and finding... Who is this? This is Masterson.
Lily Masterson. In a black bikini.
In a black bikini who with these binoculars. And I think you pointed this out, Matt.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It was very... The shots were all very rear window-y. They had like... I mean, I don't know the cinema terms, but top and bottom of the screen were blocked off. They had the big binoculars and like really close-up shots of them, close-up shots of Goldfinger, and that's just what it reminded me of.
Yeah. For that too. Oh.
Yeah, no, and it's funny because this is 60s, so at this point, Hitchcock was near his height. Like,
yeah.
And even if it's not him doing one scene, which you occasionally get from these kinds of movies, it's just this perfect representation of what it looks like to do a Hitchcock film in the era when he was still in England, you know, so...
Which was very, I mean, I'm glad they decided to go with that sort of thing with it, but really not in line with the rest of the cinematography of the movie. So.
No, and it's this cool little scene, like, because in this movie we get a different kind of Bond, and so far almost every movie we've gotten a different Bond. But here he's really playing the Cold War spy game of, you know, being the, what we think of as Bond, you know, flirting with the women, getting inside of these rooms.
Getting inside the women.
Well, I mean, come on. Someone else shoots him like three times.
But he only double O's two of them.
He does. Only two. Which is a shame.
Yeah. Well,
was it only the two? It was five?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was Masterson and then Pussy Galore.
The woman at the beginning, didn't we say it was implied?
Well, I mean, it was implied. Well, but that's a previous mission.
That's true.
Previous.
You can imply a lot of things.
It happened in the opening sequence, or like the opening sequence died with that happening. Yes, we could account that as, but it happened before the movie started. True. So. Yeah.
It's almost like you go to a sub place and you get them punched each card. Like, it's like, well, on this mission, you only got two punches, so you got to try harder next time.
He also didn't. One after 10.
He also didn't drink enough for my taste. Although they keep referencing him being an alcoholic, which is funny.
He had two drinks.
Well,
no, although, three. The one in the beginning,
and at the end, he ordered drinks for free.
Oh, that's right.
Please.
He did.
Felix ordered for him, which is even worse. I do like though that this one. At one point, after he hooks up with Masterson, he reaches into the ice bucket and feels the Dom 53, and he's like, it's too warm. And he goes, don't worry, I have another bottle. And he goes, I forget what the exact line is, and someone will
but
correct
drinking,
me.
Drinking a bottle of Dom Perignon over the correct temperature of 38 degrees Fahrenheit is like listening to the Beatles without earmuffs.
There it is. There it is. I mean, and that's what it is. Like, this is... We talked about this before, but Bond knows Dom Perignon. Like,
Bond knows lots of things.
And this is one of the ones where you're just like, wait, what? Like, because he knows more than M, and you're like, well, why aren't you M? Almost, right? Because he talks about the different kinds of nuclear weapons at one point.
And how painting women, as long as they're an exposed section, like beneath X vertebrae, they'll be fine.
Which lets you... Okay, well...
We're jumped way ahead.
Yeah. Well, actually, there's we haven't jumped that far ahead.
I don't want to talk about.
So, Bond is... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, where were we in the...
No, we're just about there. Okay. Bond is up there with Masterson.
Yes.
And this is specifically Jill Masterson, because we meet her sister later, who disappears from the movie at one point, and we never hear from her again.
No, she was killed.
She died.
Oh, that's right. She was killed by the hat.
Yeah.
Who smacked her into the jaw. I mean, if this was Tarantino, it would have cut her head clear off. But yeah, we didn't get to see that, unfortunately. excuse me. So what happens is Bond, you know, nails Masterson, who's been essentially helping him cheat at bridge. Goldfinger cheated. Jin. And
so she's watching his opponent's cards and speaking through a microphone into his
earpiece.
So he can cheat.
So he knows what cards that are had.
He shouldn't discard. That would be good for him.
And so, I guess these are high stakes games enough that either Goldfinger is playing it or
$5
Felix is
a point. And I can't remember how the points get in Jin, but I think they can get pretty high. Because
well,
as he said
that,
at the end, 15,000.
Yeah,
I mean...
Which, and to put it into context, because none of this is 1960s money, so it doesn't mean much. It's as much as 2 bricks of gold, which we established later is worth $5,000.
Yeah.
Nazi gold. Special gold.
I feel like that should be worth more, too. I mean, it had like the nice insignia.
But it wouldn't be, because the chances are Goldfinger would just melt it down and make it into something else, because gold is...
True.
I really wanted him to have, at one point, like, gloves on, and he reveals that he has a gold hand. Literally gold fingers.
A hand of Midas, so to speak.
Literally gold fingers.
Well, yeah.
Because Shirley Bassey says he has the Midas touch. And we all know how that story ends. Because I saw the Muppets version when I was a kid. He turns himself to gold. That would have been a great death, too. The bomb kind of goes
how
off,
would
the
they
gold
have
melts.
Done that?
I love gold.
I'm sorry. It makes me hate Goldmember all the more.
It really does. Like,
it would have been like Boris at the end of GoldenEye. Where
yes,
like a molten
vat of molten gold.
Of molten gold just falls over him, and he's still frozen.
Turns into a shitty statue. anyway, so long story short, Bond is sleeping with Masterson, wakes up to get more Dom Perignon, and a henchman we hadn't seen before shows up, knocks Bond out cold, and when Bond comes to, there's this gleam off screen, lighting up the whole hotel room with orangey glow. And we see Masterson is now not only dead, but covered in gold. And the presumption is, apparently, she was covered in gold paint, and that was what killed her. Which is a really weird thing to think about, meaning that she was alive and potentially unconscious, hopefully, but otherwise struggling as they painted her with gold and didn't get any on the sheets. Just throwing that
she
out there.
She was painted somewhere else. And
they have a little spray booth that they...
And they make
like
it...
a spray tan.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's actually really neat because they make it very clear that the entire body has to be covered to die, which, again, if you've watched Mythbusters, you know isn't true. But it's kind of a neat idea. And to prove this, they actually don't show her whole body because she is actually buck naked on the bed. And so there's like strategically placed chairs and things to make you realize, oh, she's actually completely painted, which is kind of neat.
Yeah.
And then we have this kind of quick cut where seen earlier, he calls up Felix and goes, Felix, it's happened again. Send the cleanup crew. James! Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
You almost feel like Felix was upset because Dink might have been his massage girl, too. Like it was.
He takes it very personally. It's kind of weird.
Not Dink.
No, Tink. I'm sorry. It wasn't Tink. It was another girl. Oh, good. Thanks, Bond. How many people is this now? It's like Red Hind needs a new punch card. So then the next cut
to
is
England.
He's in M's for England. For Queen and Country, Bond. Yes. So we have M. Then we get to M's office, and he's like, "How do you keep killing women when you plow them? Am I doing it wrong?"
That's pretty good.
Thanks.
I was going to make a plowman's loaf joke, but I didn't quite get the joke down, so I figured I'd just mention it.
Something about meat pies?
Yep.
But yeah, no. So we get this scene with M where he's kind of like, now don't do it again. We're going to put 008 on the case.
I'm well aware of my shortcomings, sir. It was a comment that was made.
Yeah, I mean, Bond kind of screws this up. He was, whether or not he was actually on vacation, we don't know, but he was definitely just kind of hanging out and is given a very simple mission to observe.
And the girl ends up dead.
And the girl ends up dead.
In a spectacular fashion that the CIA has to clear up.
And so Bernard Lee is just kind of looking like, the hell is wrong with you?
This is the start of that Bond trope where everything just explodes when he touches it.
Yeah. And I mean, it's all the worse because, again, his mission is so simple. And he goes too far. Which I guess is fine. It's the nature of this movie, but...
Restraint is not a word this series knows.
No, and it's right on the nose about it the whole way through. But essentially he goes, look, there's this Goldfinger fellow who's more than we thought. Show back up at 7 o'clock or whatever, black tie. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the Alec Baldwin line. You know, he's not a farmer. It's after 6 you wear
a tuxedo. What, are you a farmer?
And so they're headed to Bank of England. Although it is worth
mentioning. You missed the Money Penny scene.
I was going to say. Please, give me the Money Penny scene.
There were a lot of allusions to marriage in this Moneypenny scene. Like, in previous, it's like, you know, just dating or going out. And she's like, she's very fixated on matrimony.
Well, she had said, or something along the lines of, like, what do you know about Goldfinger? And she said, well, the only thing I know about gold is the, like, small band you wear on your ring finger.
On the third finger on your left hand. Which it's wrong. It's the second finger.
The thumb doesn't count.
The thumb is not a finger. My God, you're right.
Yeah.
You have finger insurance. Counts, man. Thumb insurance. Yeah, right.
Highlight of the Moneypenny scene, she does the hat toss as well and nails it.
And nails it right away. And Bond is kind of like, well, clever girl. Like, I don't know. He gives this one little look.
But other than that, it was just like a couple marriage quips and a hat toss. Like, there wasn't too much.
Although she gets the line, I hope it's not another woman. And M goes, no, it's me, Miss Moneypenny.
That was good. And I love that he knows, like, that he just knows about the verbal repartee, and he just turned the speaker on so he could listen.
It's like, this is a good time to let them know I'm listening.
Well, and I think that's even his line. He goes, can you make done with the pleasantries? Bond has somewhere to be. And then, again, there's a cut to whatever. It's this huge chamber, apparently, with the head of the Bank of England, right? And they're talking about gold, and Goldfinger's part in it, right?
So this is the economics lesson of the movie.
Yes, please.
Where the head of the bank, presumably the head of the Bank of England, is telling Bond that the U.S. and U.K. keep gold stocks. Presumably they're still on the gold standard. So gold actually matters to the economy, and the national economy at that. And there's only so much. So they like to keep track of all the gold in the world and where it's going and all that, whatnot.
To make sure a lot of it doesn't leave the country, because if a lot of it leaves, some of their stock is based on just the fact that it's sitting nationally, you know, domestically, not just necessarily in their stores, just domestically.
Privately
in general.
Held. Yeah. And they've somehow twigged that Goldfinger, who is a big gold trader and buyer and seller.
And jeweler, yeah.
And jeweler. He's got places all around the world that deal in gold, and somehow they suspect he's smuggling gold out of England to elsewhere, or out of places to other places. He's smuggling.
Because we're not on, like, an internationally based commodities market. They said, what is it, in England, the price of gold was like
$30. $30. He could buy it at $30 there and sell it in Pakistan for $110.
Exactly.
And they don't like someone else making money off them.
Well, yeah.
Well, and the whole... There's some weird, like, Nazi undertones to this movie, which is...
Well, blatant undertones, too.
Yes. Some are less subtle than others. But as you mentioned before, at one point, the actor was actually part of the Nazi party, but was may or may not have been there as a spy. Like, apparently when this movie first came out, it was banned in Israel. We watched this with our buddy Daniel, and he was bringing this stuff up. The actor, a guy by the name of Gert Frobe, but there's an umlaut, so God knows how you pronounce it. I'm not German. I'm sorry. That was not helpful.
No. Carry on.
But ultimately, he was in the Nazi party, but he was hiding Jews. So, like, at first it was actually banned in Israel, but then as more of him was found out about after things were declassified, it was allowed. Like, he's actually this kind of weird hero character. This movie, though, really does paint him as this... like, sometimes more or less subtle, but Nazi guy. Like, he has smelters and it's all hidden, but he immediately recognizes Nazi gold. He's based in Switzerland, which
has... The swastika helped.
but he did know exactly the smelter and that's everything. Right. He's like,
He knew how much it cost.
Couldn't that be his love of gold, though?
It could be, but this stuff it's even in Switzerland. Like, in the 60s especially, this was a much bigger deal. But, like, the idea that the Nazis were hiding gold in Switzerland is not unknown.
If he had been in Argentina, it would have been just as...
Right, like, that would have been part two.
Yeah.
We haven't even gotten to the mint juleps yet, but it's a weird choice midway through. But yeah, so they take out this block of gold, one of your standard gold bricks, you know how it works.
You could hold in your pocket. I mean, not just hold in your pocket. Play a few, you know, holes of golf with, I mean.
Yeah, we'll get to this weirdness.
But yeah, the bank guy gives Bond this Nazi gold.
Yes.
Apparently it's the only bar of Nazi gold that Britain has. Officially, and he says something to the effect of, "This will get his attention. Go find out what
use it however you want. Just bring it back.
Exactly.
And it's worth 5,000 pounds." And Bond's like, and he goes, "We'll give it to Q first because you look like you're about to steal it. Just go out on the town." And it's also all the rarer. And it's funny you mentioned that. I hadn't thought about it, but you're like, do the English have more Nazi gold? Because that's the subtle.
I think so. Yeah.
That's the undertone of it. Because we had to fish it out of the bottom of a lake, and you're just like,
Well, the Goldfinger had said, like, well, that gold's been missing for, you know, X amount of years.
No, I'm just talking about the script writers, like, because, like, if this is in the book, this is one of those things that you get the feeling that Fleming knows a little bit more about that they were willing to actually put after they filmed this in Pion, you know, and the Broccoli's got their hands on it. And you're just like, you can't.
Well, they're still finding Nazi gold. They just found, like, a big train load in Germany or Poland or something.
Yeah. No, it's the fact. Anyway, moving ahead.
Q branch.
Q.
Q branch scene where you actually see the office and all of the gadgets and stuff. This is
and them testing
one.
Other gadgets on other people. The opening to it is two guys in like Q outfits, right, with gas masks on, hitting a parking meter and just spraying the room with gas, which is great.
What is the application?
That's what I wanted to know. Like, how is this useful?
Is this like quelling riots where they happen to be hitting parking
meters?
This is
to deal with Cool Hand Luke in a few
years. No, it makes no sense.
No, it doesn't.
There's no use for this. It's, you know, I first got exposed to this as like a weird side thing. Watching the old Naked Gun movies, where like they have a Q scene for no reason, and that's what it is. Like rioters who are people who are graffitiing walls get kicked in the nuts by the wall or whatever. It's just like, no, this makes no sense. There's no application for this. I guess unless you're going to Red China or to Moscow and just setting these up so people get gassed in the streets.
Random civilians getting gassed, yeah.
Which frankly, based on what's going to happen later, theoretically could be the plot.
But actually, my favorite was not that. My favorite was the submachine gun pointed at the guy in the trench coat that they fired. It, you know, and he's wearing something underneath, which you must assume must be some other form of body armor as well. It's like, that one's not ready yet. You're like, wait.
So the fact that he's still standing was a successful trial.
Which I thought was strange. I initially thought, like, are those incendiary rounds? What are they testing here? It's like, it's just a bulletproof vest.
I think they were testing bulletproof clothing. Was the
when he had the... vest on
just
on
in case, yeah. Okay. And I think that, but it was just kind of like
that makes more sense.
Yeah. But still, it's like, why couldn't you have just tested that on like a dummy?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then Bond walks up to Desmond Llewellyn playing Q and just picks up a grenade off the table and starts kind of tossing it. He's like,
and it was in something. I almost wanted to go back, but we were all watching. Like, what was the grenade in when he?
I don't know.
It was
like
a shaving cream can or
something. And it was just like, can you please? Really? Can you just please, Mr. Bond? And he just puts it back down. It's like, this is here for a reason. Like, because in the last scene, Bond is almost terrified about using, like, a briefcase. Like, he's, like, very, like, I think I understand. Thank you, sir. And in this one, he's just, like, dicking around with Q. He's almost juggling a grenade. And he's just like, oh. No, there's a reason why Q's an asshole to Bond. Because Bond has probably almost killed him a dozen times.
And he even makes a point that, can you please bring this back in one piece?
For once.
For once. Yes.
And you're like, there's been other missions. We get that because it's, what, 3 years later or whatever. But at the same time, you're just like, oh, no. Q is sick of it.
Yeah.
Like, I love that. And I love when Q has to put Bond back in his place.
Yep.
Because it doesn't have, like, at times he's almost, like, vicious. But, like, nowadays, here he's just like, really? Are you a child? Like, I already have to fix your syphilis once a week. Like, like it's just so... anyway, and so then we finally get what stopped the movie for me just for this beautiful second, the DB5.
Yep. Which is really, I mean, looking back, it's like, that's so iconic. It's like the star of the movie. You get this awesome car, they use it so much, and they use it well.
Well, and to your point, apparently in the books, it's been a while since I've read them all, but he wins off of Le Chief a DB5. And so it's his personal car. And that's why we even see in the more recent ones Daniel Craig driving around in one.
Uh-huh. Yes. Because, okay. they won it in Casino Royale in the movie, too. They made he didn't win it from Le Chief, but he won it from the other guy.
Right. Yeah. And so it's his actual car. And so here, we actually get introduced to it for the first time as a Bond movie. And there's a reason why it's the iconic car. And even now when he's driving the DB11, DB10, it's different because he still also has the DB5.
Yeah.
Like, it's a beautiful car here. But is it a normal car? Why, I don't think it is.
No.
Who wrote all these down?
I got a bunch of these. You want to go through and we'll make sure we're...
Yeah, so I had... I included the tracking device because of that nifty radar thing.
Yeah, he basically had GPS before the rest of us did.
And how did he get those maps to update? He had maps of the entire United States and other
countries. And Europe. So obviously a world...
Geneva.
Yeah.
He had smokescreen.
Yep.
Oil slicks.
Yep.
The raising bulletproof screen that covered the back window, which didn't make sense because the windscreen was the windshield was bulletproof. Why not make the back window bulletproof?
Was the front windshield?
Yeah.
Because that woman took out
with the MP40.
MP40.
Because that was one of the details. Bulletproof windshield. So why not just build bulletproof rear window? But that's fine.
Yeah. Anyway.
Let's see. Did I have another one? The front machine guns.
Yep.
And the ejector seat.
Yes.
When Q is describing the ejector seat, he gets the great line, "Well, surely you must be joking. I never joke about my work."
You did miss one. See. The tire taker out. Spinning blade on the tires.
Did he use the machine guns?
Yes, he did. He was in the alley approaching the fake car, the mirror.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right, he did.
Yeah.
Which are really useless. You can only aim right where you're driving.
Although it would
really
make traffic much more satisfying.
But then the cars just stop in front of you. You can't go around them.
Ah, damn it. Bazookas. Blow them up.
Yeah, bazookas, yeah.
But this
is a tricked out car.
It's a tricked out car, and he has the Ben-Hur style wheel cutters, which we'll get to in a second. Yeah.
But the face on Sean Connery when Q is describing the ejector seat to him is great.
Well, and
it's like a child in a candy store.
And we need to be specific here. It only ejects the passenger seat, which is on our worksheet, we talk about Q gadgets. Some are practical, some are contrived. This is the most Chekhov's gunian. Because does it eject the driver's seat? No. Does it eject the back seat? No. Only if there's a passenger in the passenger's seat, if they're riding shotgun, it hurts them. That's literally it. And so if you need it in a situation like you're about to drive off a cliff and you need an ejector seat, the driver's still fucked. Right? It's completely...
It's not even
literally,
the option.
It's literally for the situation Bond is in and no other situation.
Yeah.
Unlike the briefcase, which we don't see, but comes back and kills henchmen.
Yes, they reference it. It's like, has anybody seen my attaché case? Sadly, it was damaged when they were investigating it. And you don't even think about it until, actually watching this order made that... Reasonable, because I don't know if I've ever
watching them in close. Watching this one a week after watching From Russia with Love, you realize it's standard issue.
Yeah,
and I've never thought about that before. Like it never struck me. Oh, Tashi Kirst was damaged. Oh, okay. Not thinking. Oh, they popped it open wrong. And
also, I was thinking about this too. When you're a kid and you're learning about NASA and they talk about all the inventions that they invented that we use every day, like dehydrated drinks and just add water and Velcro. Apparently, Q Branch invented wrinkle-proof suits because Bond pulls a suit out of a briefcase and it's crisp and clean and perfect. You're just like, is it Bond's charisma? Oh no, Q has some. You almost see the glint in Q's eye when he shows some of this stuff off, and you're just like, this man knows what he's doing. This is great. That's so good. So the next cut we have is Geneva, right?
No, it's golf, isn't it?
Golf.
Golf. No,
it's golf.
So he's in Kent.
Yes.
Because Goldfinger owns a golf course down there, and I guess it's near one of his operations.
Yeah.
So he plays golf a lot.
Well, yeah, we even find out he owns the club.
Yeah.
So
And so, again, the problem with, this whole plot is this is possibly the most complicated Bond plot for the villain. Because the way Bond stumbles into this is fascinating, right? It's actual spycraft. Bond is, you know, wearing, you know, a black turtleneck outfit where he's sneaking in, listening into windows, like, going around. And so, like, all we know is Goldfinger's doing something weird. With the amount of gold that goes through his hands, it's more than the jewelry, it's more than anything. He's mm-hmm. clearly, like Thomas said at the top, because of the Cold War, there isn't a universal gold exchange. There's not a flat rate. And if he can get gold from cheaper areas to more expensive areas, he can make money. They can't figure out how he's moving this gold, but he's clearly moving it. So he goes to Kent because, as a jeweler, he's allowed to own metallurgical stations. One of his jewelry factories happens to be in Kent. That's all we know. So he goes to play golf at his golf club to find out some information.
I mean, it's just one of those things. This is also something we can tack on that Bond knows because he knows golf. Like, he has to be good enough to make this work. Like, you know.
And it's funny because I was talking to John about this in the car on the way to dinner. But, like, this is an era with gentlemanly heroes and gentlemanly villains. This is, you know, Sherlock Holmes and Moriarty, right? This isn't Tom Cruise, you know, punching people, right? Or the Bourne movies. That's not this kind of spycraft. And of course Bond plays golf. And of course he plays obscure card games, right? He knows gin even if it's not his game.
Yep.
He knows what's that stupid game? Baccarat.
Baccarat.
The one that no one knows. I think they only teach it at spy school. It's you know, if you go around the table, so who's MI5?
Like, the goal is to add up the image. I remember actually because of the books, they actually explain it in Casino Royale so you can actually understand.
Because no one else plays that game.
Well, I mean, it's no, because it's only played, because I actually looked up in casinos, like, well, how do you play this game? It's really only played in casinos in the high roller suites. And actually, this one's really interesting, and I know this from an accounting perspective. There are generally special line items on income statements for how much a casino takes in or loses because of Baccarat.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really? That high stakes. Wow. Yes, it is generally its own line item in certain casinos where it is played because it can be huge.
Well, and this makes sense to me. But it's so funny that other things, like Bond has his favorite cocktail, makes sense because he's someone who's in that field a lot, but that he likes specifically Dom Perignon.
And that brandy breakdown we get after that brandy tasting.
Oh, my God. So this is stealing from another podcast, so I'm not going to go into it. But on James Bonding, they do the most English person in the movie, the most – not even English, the most British person. At this scene in the banker's dinner, wherever they're having, and they're on their third course, and they're at the end. They're done. They're having their brandy at the end, and they're having cigars, right? And Bond is guessing brandy's age, and they're like – well, you know, brandy doesn't really have a age. I was talking about the wine that the brandy was made with.
And he lists off what he thinks the composition of the wines in the brandy are, right?
And M is like, no, M is like, really? Who's giving the lecture here?
Yeah, no, M is almost embarrassed. And because the banker's like, why? It's actually a, you know, something, something, blank, blank, blank. And he goes, well, I always find that this wine has too much of this and this. And I think it's a little overrated. And M's like, are you freaking kidding me? Are you arguing with him about this? Like, literally, the economy of England is at stake. And you're arguing about this cement. And the guy's accent gets stronger and stronger. Like, I believe you're wrong, Mr. Bond. He goes, oh, no, I apologize, but it's 30. And you're just like, my God, what is happening?
M sniffs it later to try to figure out what Bond is.
And you realize that his liver has processed a lot of brandy in his day. And it's not even his favorite. That's my favorite part. He would never order brandy on his own.
No.
No.
No, he did. He did later. On the plane.
Oh, you're right.
But on the plane later when he's being taken, when he's after, you know, the kidnapping and he's having a meal. With him is a glass of brandy.
Yes.
Now, if it was that same specific mixture of brandy,
yes.
That would have been a whole nother level to this movie.
I heard you hated this brandy, Mr. Bond. And he goes, oh, it's overrated. He goes, I have a whole bottle. Oh, Goldfinger. You always know how to rub me just the wrong way, gentlemanly. Like, how great is that? Mm-hmm. I'm going to offer you a cocktail, but it's going to be just slightly... I shook it instead of stirred it. Like, you're just like, oh, my God. You asshole. So he ends up playing golf with Goldfinger. And who wants to talk about the golf game? Oh, we got this.
I can take this. So basically, guy at the pro shop, Auric walks in. Goldfinger walks in and they're getting ready to play. I guess there might be semi-weekly game.
Are you on a first-name basis with Goldfinger, Thomas?
apparently.
Mr. Oryk.
Mr. Goldfinger. And walks in. The guy goes, well, I mean, we could play, but I have somebody who's, I guess, closer, you know, same handicap you have. And so they get started. And so basically, what is it? This is where we actually meet Oddjob for the first, well, we actually see him. And then, you know, I guess we see several holes in and Bond walks over and kind of like, you know, or Goldfinger's like, you know, you're not just here for a game of golf. It's very obvious that Goldfinger knows who Bond is. Like, you could see it in the beginning when Bond introduces himself. There's almost this twinge of recognition. He's like, I know that voice. Like, mm-hmm. And so Bond basically drops the gold brick right on the ground. And
says there's more where that came from.
Yes.
Well, and it's just, again, going back to gentlemanly kind of spycraft. Because, you know, they start playing whatever it is, a shilling a hole or whatever it is. And they're evenly matched. So theoretically, it should be fine, right? And then once Bond drops the gold, it's this, like, it's the last three holes or whatever it's supposed to be. And he goes, well, I'll play you for the gold. It's like, it's worth £5,000. And he's like, well, then you can pay me in cash. Like, same way.
I always liked the scene, too, and I remembered it. When he drops the gold bar down and he makes the putt that the hole is now right next to the gold bar, Goldfinger's ball just kind of like veers way off towards the gold.
And you're just like, oh, yeah, it's single-minded. It is so great, like, because it's all so, it's pageantry. It's this wonder, because Bond is dressed like you'd imagine a guy in the 60s playing golf. He has his hat on, he has this wonderful suit, he looks like a mixture
of short pants, like those.
But he's just like Arnold Palmer. Like, yep. He knows exactly what it is. Or Goldfinger is classier. He's old school, right? And he's wearing the knickers. He's wearing the socks tucked up into them. And he's still wearing, everything is mustard colored or
like
auburn.
Didn't he have the beanie hat too?
Yeah.
He always has the little flat caps on. Yeah. And he looks good in them, damn it. And he's has apparently such a strong German accent. They had another guy do the voice just like the French woman in From Russia with Love, right? But you buy him as, this is a very gentlemanly competition. It's what they wanted to do. Unfortunately, I'm going to bring up a shitty Bond movie, Die Another Day with the sword fighting. The difference here is they just actually play golf. Mm-hmm. And they're saying strict rules of golf? Yes, strict rules of golf. And so Bond gets him on a technicality because he plays the wrong ball because Bond tricks him.
Well, because Goldfinger was cheating. And mm-hmm. So Bond decided to play...
to cheat back.
Yeah.
And it's this wonderful way where... And my favorite part about it is if it were another Bond, if it were another movie... Goldfinger would have refused to pay. But because it's Bond, and it's because it's this Bond, and it's this classy, he still pays the check, even though he knows Bond screwed him over. That's all it is. It's fantastic.
And like we said, he knows Bond from Miami. He said, this is the second time we've crossed paths. Yeah. This is the second time you've messed me up. Let's just not have that happen again, okay? Here's your check. Goodbye.
Yeah.
And he's willing to call it quits right there. And it's Bond that pushes it, and he kind of...
Is there another wager in the movie after that?
No, except Bond is playing the same kind of game in reverse when he's strapped to the table. And he's like, I know what Operation Grand Slam. Yeah. Like, because it's the same kind of wager that he's setting, but it's different. He's playing for his life, which I know sounds much more like a screenwriting thing. But the scenes are even structured the same, you know.
And this is where we see one of the other vehicles, the Phantom 337 Rolls-Royce.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Another beautiful
car. This movie was all about the vehicles.
It really was.
And it's, God, and it's beautiful shots because you have a scene straight out of a Top Gear episode where they're driving along the Alps in Geneva, which we haven't even gotten to yet.
Yeah, but it's the next scene. It's the next scene.
But, so. Like, you know, Goldfinger's car is this beautiful Phantom from 1937, the Phantom 337. And it's just, and it even has this option because it's still effectively like an old carriage where... Oddjob's, like, part of it as the driver is not even covered, but in the back seat, Goldfinger has this desk that folds down so he can write Bond a check, even though he knows Bond screwed him over. Again, the gentlemanly games of spycraft. It's wonderful.
Because he knows he cheated too.
And Bond takes out of his pocket the actual golf ball and he goes, I believe this is yours, hands it to Oddjob, and Oddjob, while making eye contact the whole time, turns the ball to dust, just crushes it in his hand. And Bond is terrified. His face goes pale and his jaw kind of slowly slouches. You're just like, oh god, Bond knows this guy could kill him.
Well, and that's the real introduction to Oddjob. We get the golf ball crush and the hat throw.
And the hat throw, where he cuts the head off a statue. Well, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I just want to say, would this be kind of the first henchman, because I can't really remember Dr. No No, there wasn't really a henchman. I mean, you had...
Not the same way, no.
No, this is the first henchman that is, in terms of sheer strength, outclasses Bond. Like, yes. By a...
It's practically a superpower.
Yes, exactly. By a sizable factor. Like, this is not somebody that Bond could overpower.
And it's such great kind of... First of all, he's a mute. He grunts and points occasionally, but he's a mute. And his outfit is so, like... He's Asiatic. I think he's Japanese in the book, you said. Here, he's just generic. I mean,
they said he was Korean.
Korean?
Well, that's what Goldfinger called him Korean.
But he's even dressed up like the cliched way that Japanese would dress up, with the top hat and the suit. And he just, and his hands are always pulling down on the lapels of his jacket or clenching his fist. Like, he's this quintessential strongman type. Like, again, it's very much like Spectre this time around, with Dave Bautista playing Hinks.
Only Oddjob had class.
He does. He's wearing the top hat the whole time. Mm-hmm. And, like, Bond flips up the top hat and you see this metal brim. Like, this is no joke. This is a deadly game that they're playing, but it's still gentlemanly. Like,
it's funny, though, speaking of the metal hat and the dressed up, there was a similar show at the time, very spies in England, called The Avengers. Oh. And the main character from that, John Steed, had a metal hat, bowler hat that he would throw and knock people out.
Really?
And yeah.
Honor Blackman had to quit that show to do this movie.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. Yeah.
And that's, I guess, the closest to an homage to it. But again, you realize how much like spy stuff existed in this era. So for Bond to survive, how unique it had to be. Like, I don't know, but this is... It's such a neat little thing that the henchman has this thing, but also that it's this. It's so, I don't know. It's
over
great.
The top, but it's not so over the top, like a Jaws kind of over the top. Yeah. It's almost believable.
And that's actually the good comparison. This is how Sean Connery would do it, and Jaws is how Roger Moore would do it. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
And like, it's also practical. Not that we all
should. Not in the strictest sense.
but it's still a real thing. You know, yeah. It's not like he has like lasers or he has
or
some
a
sort of
saw in the hat or something.
Right. Yeah. It's just a heavier rim. So when you throw it, it does damage. Fine. Like, that's practical. No one would notice. But he can still flex his muscles and throw it, mm-hmm. and do real damage, substantial damage. Which is cool.
So before we leave the golf course, I just want to mention my favorite secondary character of the movie, James Bond's caddy. And I don't remember the lines or anything, but go back and watch it and just enjoy the caddy he gets for the...
Oh, because like he's like a drunk cartoon character.
Yeah.
Because Sean Connery has a very like refined upper class Scottish accent. And this guy's like, if
that's his ball, then I'm Arnold Palmer.
Yeah. And he goes, I know. I have his ball here, and he's standing on it, and you're just like, of course you are. And he's explaining the jokes. Like, he's like, but if he hits the other ball, he'll lose. He goes, I know. And you're just like, of course he does. But it's your honor, sir. He goes, it's fine, just let him hit it.
Well, it was almost to the point, he was explaining everything. To the point where I just wanted him to shut up because I felt like Goldfinger would hear him.
And it's Bond like, does the same thing.
It's like, did you swap the balls out, Mr. Bond? Yes, I did. Yeah. Thanks
God
for telling
damn it,
me.
Caddy. And Bond goes, you know, he goes, it's your honor. And he goes, I know, but let him go first. Trust me, because if he hits the ball, I'll win. It's just so wonderful. It's
the
just
tension
so,
of the ball falling off of the tee.
The tension of Oddjob shaking his pant leg and a ball falling out. And he goes, argh! And you're just like, it's very Frankenstein's monster from those movies. Anyway, so Auric pulls down the thing, writes the check to James Bond. We get a good Bond, James Bond here. I know we're jumping way back to the beginning, but he says that to, what's her name? The Observer. What's her name? Jill.
Oh, yes.
Masterson. But, you know, here, he goes, Mr. Bond, here's your check. Now, if I ever see you again, ooh, you kids!
You'll rue the day.
And he slips into the back of the car, a homing device the size of a package of cigarettes, I think the Q puts it. Puts it up in the trunk, and he follows them to the airport. They're flying to Geneva on a 747. The 747 even has the whole car inside. So Bond's going to Geneva, I guess. And when they land, we have a weird scene where Bond is nearly run off the road by a Ford Mustang. Of all the cars in this movie, I'm torn because I love a lot of them. I could never afford a DB5. I could never afford any of these cars. Let's be honest.
You can afford an old Mustang.
You can afford an old Mustang.
A 1976 Mustang is the one I want. Or sorry, 67. 63, 64, 60. It's 64. This movie came out in 64.
Yeah.
So 60, somewhere between 60 and 64, they were the same design. I want one of those of any of these cars. Not just because a DB5 you can never repair and would probably break down on you. And the Phantom, you need a second driver.
And you'd never fit in the DB5.
I would never fit one anyway. But that car, man, the top down, tried to negotiate those mountain roads. I'm like, does she die? I was just thinking she was going to like try to take a stiff turn on the Alps and just plummet to her doom. John, tell me about this ride in the Alps.
Well, it's very reminiscent of the GoldenEye sequence where we're introduced to Xenia on a top, but Bond is driving through the Alps, tailing Goldfinger, and suddenly this girl comes up in the Ford Mustang and starts honking her horn incessantly at him, and he kind of pulls over and she goes on by. And I guess further down the road, Goldfinger is stopped to buy flowers.
Something.
I don't know what he is doing.
I think he has an apple at one point, too. And you're just like, all right.
We pull back from that scene to the curve in the road up the mountain, and we see Bond parked his car. He's watching Goldfinger. We pull back even further. We see this girl in the Mustang. She's got a rifle aimed down. She takes a shot, and it poofs next to Bond's feet. So she just took a shot at James Bond.
Well, and the weird part about it to me, too, is Oddjob hears it and smiles as though it was his assassin.
And that's what... Yeah, it was odd.
And that's possibly the weirdest part of this, because at the end, she wants to kill Goldfinger because she's
just a really lousy shot.
She's the sister.
Tremendously lousy.
Yeah.
She's Jill's sister, Tiffany?
Tilly.
It is Tilly. And
she's taking revenge on Goldfinger for killing
Tilly
Jill.
Soames.
Well, that's the name she gave.
But it's actually Tilly Masterson.
Yeah. Her gun case apparently has TM on it rather than TS.
Ah, yes.
Why her gun case has her name on it?
You got to monogram your gun case.
I guess. we're never really shown why she has a gun case for a collapsible rifle.
She's a terrible shot. Everything about her character is weak.
Yeah.
All of this is forgiven by the cinematography in the Alps, though.
Which is
gorgeous.
It is amazing.
And again, in this Blu-ray, like, and trust me, I get it. People stream these movies, but if you don't have a fast internet connection, get the Blu-ray. It's the most beautiful shot.
It's gorgeous.
And you realize there's a different... When you have it on film stock, I can't tell the texture, but definitely the colors are more vivid. And this is the Technicolor Kodachrome Arrow, and everything is brilliant. It's amazing. Bond is literally standing on this ridge, on this kind of roadway, looking down, just like with his hands in his pockets, like, oh, that Goldfinger. And then all of a sudden, this woman shoots at him. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, though, they're driving along again. Bond runs her off the road using the side spokes, right? The things that cut up her tire.
Her. Starts at the front tire, works his way back.
Hits the brakes, and she doesn't notice any of it. She's like, oh, I have a double blowout. And Bond's like, oh, those are dangerous. You want to ride with me into town?
Ignoring the fact that he pretty much just cane opened her car.
And she denies him his Bond, James Bond line.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm Bond. I don't care what you are.
I don't care.
Well, and even better than that, it's not that he just gets denied. He gets shot down, which is great. His charms don't even... She doesn't flinch. And you think the whole time she's playing at, like, well, I'm trying to kill you, and he's just trying to flirt with her. No. Her plans are completely different. She's just ignoring everything. It's amazing. It's the first time we've seen Bond get 100% shot down. Mm-hmm. And we're halfway into Bond's rapiness. This is pretty bad.
He is insistent.
He is. And so she gets dropped off at this...
the Volkswagen gas station.
Yeah. To get new tires, but since it's an American car, it will take like 9 days or whatever, and so she's stuck there.
And turns down his offer of either ride to a hotel.
Which is, yeah.
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 God damn fun. I mean, yeah, he's skeezy in this movie.
So I guess he gives up and finally gets back to trailing.
Is this where he has the line where it's like, Bond, contain yourself?
Yes,
and he's
yes,
speaking to himself. Yeah.
Yes, he does.
Because the first time she runs him off the road, it's almost kind of like he's like, well, maybe I should drag race. And no, he's just like, Bond.
Discipline.
Discipline.
Yeah.
Mission first.
Stiff upper lip, think of the queen. Oh, Elizabeth. But that's what it is. Like, and then ultimately he decides to drive on, then she interferes again, so he gets involved. But the next shot we see is he finds Auric Incorporated, or whatever it's called, like the actual smelting plant in Geneva. And he's observing it overnight. Then when it gets dark, he puts on his tactile neck and breaks in. Right, he's sneaking around wearing black. He, you know, kind of slips into a window and is observing a guy named Mr. Ling talking to Goldfinger about how he gets the gold across the border. And they come across a Rolls Royce where he's taking the fenders off and all the metalwork, melting it down, because what he's done is he's molded the gold into these component parts of the car, and that's how he's smuggling it across. So Bond has found out part one of his plan. But then Goldfinger drops something called Operation Grand Slam. And so now he realizes that the actual mission is Grand Slam, and he has to get to the bottom of this. In some ways, this is filmed like a 1960s chamber drama, where the information is coming out slowly, and Bond has to figure it out as we figure it out with him. And every time we think we've figured out the plot, we've only figured out whatever, like 10% more of it. Mm-hmm. That's why this is kind of interesting. Bond, unlike later or shittier Bond movies, we never know the plot before Bond does. And as Bond cracks the code, we're there with him. And it's not like Bond makes incredible leaps either. Goldfinger gives him that little bit more information each time. And so once he hears Operation Grand Slam, he knows that's what he has to get to the bottom of next. Fine. Right?
Yeah.
He follows Ling outside and starts to sneak away when all of a sudden he finds this woman again. This woman is sniping up above the hill, and it's... This is right as he's trying to figure out who she is. He knows her initials are TM, not TS. So something's askew. She has her sniper rifle, and Bond tackles her, and the barrel of her gun hits this tripwire, which sets off the alarm.
Which
and
is a mistake he would not make.
Which isn't a mistake he would not make. He would... No, I mean, one
it was,
should
It
make.
Was a clear tripwire.
It was obvious. This is weird. It's not subtle.
Yeah.
But it releases all of these kung fu enemy types. Wearing these kind of black gray denim jumpsuits with big yellow bands across them.
And I think we had mentioned it. This is really what sets the tone of the henchman outfit for the rest of the movies.
Yeah, the jumpsuit.
The jumpsuit with a belt color of choice. I mean,
which I'm sure we'll get into later, just kind of begs the question, how much is Goldfinger really like with Spectre? Since they all at least took a page out of the same villain's cheat sheet.
Well, they all shop from the same uniform supply company, clearly. I mean,
well, yeah.
I like how there's like a Cisco or something.
Henchmen's are us, yeah. H Mart.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you get your henchmen and their clothes too?
Yeah. Well, and it's actually funny you bring this up, because I think Thomas was looking this up for us. We were trying to debate whether or not Goldfinger was part of Spectre or not. And I thought for some reason the next one he's alluded to as part of this whole Spectre thing. But in this movie, he seems very much on his own. However, after this, it really does seem like every Spectre villain is based on Goldfinger, which is awesome. Goldfinger has, you know, he's the gentleman villain with the henchman, with the plot, with a very complicated plot, which we haven't even gotten a third into. Like, we've been talking almost an hour at this point. But the movie, like, the movie's plot gets more complicated, significantly more complicated, because at this point we just figure he's smuggling gold, which he is, but so much more.
So you're going to get to the point where actually Bond, like the whole chase scene that's about to happen with this. Like, yeah, I was about to jump past that.
No, please. Take us through it, in fact.
So basically, tripwire gets set. The guards are coming. Basically, Bond takes Tilly Masterson. And, is that really her name?
Tilly.
Apparently, yeah.
Lily and Tilly. Wow. Very imaginative parents we had there. And it races to the car. Henchman there. Bond knocks him out. And the chase ensues. So they're driving. I'm trying to remember. So they're driving along.
He uses all the gadgets.
He's using all the gadgets. And eventually they do get kind of stopped. And they try and run. He starts running till he gets hit by Oddjob with the
hat,
with the top hat, with the blade, and she is out. And Bond like runs over, you know, and for some reason feels very compassionate towards this woman that he hasn't even had sex with.
Yeah, this is a weird Bond, because he feels sympathy in a way that people don't usually.
Well, to be fair, he was responsible for her sister dying.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because and at some point we found out that she was the sister of the girl painted gold.
It was when he grabbed her gun. He was like, oh, TM. TM.
And no, and it was later when it was kind of like, I want to kill him. And it was like, oh.
Yeah.
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 So she wants revenge on
Well, and I mean, maybe part of it is what you said, too, which like is that he would not usually make such a mistake that would set off the alarm. And so he's also responsible for her death.
True.
Yeah.
And so this is Bond slipping. He's not good. And as John pointed out when we were watching this, essentially, Bond, every inkling, everything that happens, Bond makes worse or it's his mistake. Like, this whole movie. He gets pretty much all of his allies killed except for Felix and the caddy.
He's captured how many times?
Yeah. And he just keeps making it worse. Like, and it's not like he's subtle around Goldfinger. Goldfinger's like, something is wrong. You need to stop following me. And he's like, no, I'll just show up at the next place. He's like, no, don't. Like, this is really bad.
This is the time to switch spies. You are no longer useful for this. Like. Yeah. And so they carted him off, let him drive his own car, which was their mistake. And so they got one car in front and one car behind. And as the cars turn, like, you know, so then we go by Grandma, our gate guard.
Yeah.
Like, with her little old kitchenette. And so then Bond manages to veer off and start driving again with a guard in the side, which is now when the Chekhov's gun of the ejector switch comes up.
Yeah.
That goes out. Granny gets an MP40. That was right, MP40.
It was, yes. And it looked like it at least.
Yeah, that's what it looks like. It starts shooting at Bond, and it just kind of sets off a series of things that just Bond just increasingly things are not going right for
him.
He's
trying to escape the compound,
but he's stuck inside the compound.
Yeah, so he's like because Granny has Granny got her gun. he can't really escape through the. I mean, it looks like an old border crossing with this giant throw arm. And so she has him trapped on that end. So now he's driving through this kind of depot, right? It's like filled with warehouses and stuff. And he's cutting through these little alleys. And in one of the most contrived idiocies, he sees the headlights in this mirror and he shoots at it and it doesn't help. And so he's playing chicken with a mirror and he doesn't realize it's a mirror. It looks like another car. At the last minute, Bond veers off and hits a wall, which explodes like a bad movie set. And knocks himself unconscious, to which Oddjob literally just laughs at him. He looks up at the mirror and like snickers to himself, shaking his head, pulls Bond out of the car, and this is how Bond ends up trapped this time around.
And so Bond wakes up, strapped to a table, or Goldfinger standing right over there, and there's this giant thing like staring right at his head. It's basically a laser.
And it's probably the most Bond scene in any Bond movie at any Bond time.
It is a wonderful scene because also it's, you know, it's the start of the gentleman villain, but it has this wonderful thing. So, you know, Goldfinger, you know, monologues to him a little bit, doesn't give anything away. He's just like chatting at him going, this is the end of you. You screwed up. And he's just kind of having his little gloat. And then he turns the laser on. He starts to walk away. And Bond is like trying to get him to stay. And like, I mean, Goldfinger even goes, choose your next witticism wisely. It's probably your last.
And this is where Bond gets the line, you know, do you expect me to talk? And he goes, no, I expect you to die. That's it.
It's a slow killing mechanism, but Bond had no escape. There was no watch that would flip off or something he could do to trick out of this.
Which is where later movies really got it wrong.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and that's what it is. It's this moment where Bond is supposed to be terrified. And it's something they did well in Spectre. But in general, like you said, most movies do this wrong. It's not a contrived, it's not a prolonged death scene. It's a torture scene. Bond knows he's going to die. And it's going to be the slowest, most painful death imaginable. And you said at the top, this is the first time we see a laser on screen. And what is it used for? It's used to slowly kill Bond. This is worse than, like, this is like waterboarding him or something. Like, he feels like he's going to die. He's he's going to be cut in half from the beginning, starting with his power center, his Achilles penis, as we called it.
Yeah, by the time this hits his liver, he will probably be dead, but that's a slow beam. Like,
I would love the cartoon version of this because we have that. It's the episode where Homer works for
Scorpio.
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 Where Bond pulls out the quarter, flips it in the air, and then Bond just tackles him, and then Homer tackles him, and they just shoot him. Like, that's what it is.
Yeah.
But I was just thinking, like, in the cartoon version, it would hit his liver, and his liver would be stronger than the laser. Because God, he drinks. And in fact, so much so that we'll get to the end, but Felix orders him a drink for three people. But long story short, Bond gets out of this by name-dropping Operation Grand Slam. And it's such this perfect scene, because like you said, there's no out for Bond. This is the only time we really see Bond begging for his life, but he begs in a Bond way.
Panicked.
He's terrified.
Yeah, he manages to pull the right thing and save his life, but like, I mean, it was like, this is Bond's end.
And he goes like, look, 008 will replace me. And he goes, and hopefully he'll do better than you did.
Yeah.
That's it. Like, Goldfinger is completely fine with this plot.
He is completely nonplussed.
He's literally
Bond
walking
is dead.
Out the door and Bond is still trying to talk to him. He's like, bye.
And he's like, no, I have a meeting. Mr. Ling is here. I have to talk to him.
I've got things to do. You can die.
And the guy with the, like, the Coke bottle glasses is just there turning knobs on the thing, like, yes, this laser's working. Fine. It even has such a spacey sound, like, woo, 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 woo.
It's got even, like, the light beat, like, woo, 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 woo. Like,
yeah, it's so cheesy. Go ahead.
So Bond. So very Bond.
And I mean, and basically, was it he survives and they knock him out?
Yeah.
And to the next, it was.
Yeah. You know, Henchman X shows up with a little trank gun and shoots him. And he wakes up on a plane, on a whatever. They even mentioned it's a Lockheed something, something, something.
Whatever Goldfinger's plane is.
Two.
And actually, it looks like it's made out of Legos. We see a cutaway scene where it's a model floating on a screen.
That was the worst model work of the movie.
It was. It really was.
And then later in the movie, they flip it around so it's pointing the other direction and we see it again. And that's atrocious. So Bond's on this flight with a woman named Yumi and Pussy Galore. And Pussy Galore is, like you said at the time, the oldest Bond woman. She was 38.
39.
So she is Sean Connery's age, question mark? Older than him? A little older than him?
I'm not sure.
Sean Connery was young at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's this woman with the most 60s haircut we've seen yet. And she is not at all interested in Bond's games. At all.
At all.
Which is a recurring theme in this movie, really.
Yeah, no, Bond strikes out a lot in this movie, which is refreshing. As
he's
one
for three at this point.
Yeah.
To be fair, two of them died. Three of them died. Two of them.
Two of them died.
And we wonder why Bond drinks.
Yeah. And so Bond asks for a martini, shaken, not stirred. So we get that, too. This is, I think, the first time we get that.
I think so.
I believe so. Yeah.
And he gets it in a gold-lined glass because that's the theme. This whole room looks like something out of a Trump apartment from the 80s. Like, it's all, like, the can might as well be gold. Like, but it's not. It's not. But the clock in the toilet is. So that's something. So Bond demands. He has no power here. He wants a drink, right? So they give him a drink. He's talking to Pussy Galore. And before they land into Baltimore, right, he wants to change. And that's where we get the line where he had the briefcase that exploded.
Yeah, the attaché case. Oh, we're sorry. That was damaged when it was investigated, and it was just kind of left out there. And it was just very subtle. It wasn't. Hey, remember the last movie? It was just like, there it was. If you saw the last movie and you were thinking, there it was.
My favorite part about that is later we'll get this scene where the whole illusion is that Goldfinger smelts gold out of like a crushed car. So just imagine, like, there's these charred corpses because of the explosion or whatever, and he just still finds the gold sovereigns and takes them out and just pockets them because it's still gold.
Oh, yeah.
It's still gold. Almost as though he renders out the gold, like, the little number plates on the buttons and just still melts that out. He's like, hey, another third of an ounce of gold or whatever. But, yeah, so Bond goes into the bathroom, and there's all these little peepholes that he keeps seeing, but Bond apparently is a little squeamish around being watched.
So he
covers up the peephole so that he can shower and shave.
And put the
tracking device.
That's when he puts the tracking device in his shoe.
In his shoe.
Yeah.
He has two tracking devices. One, like I said, is about the size of a box of cigarettes that he puts up in the trunk. The other one is the size of, God, almost a stick of gum, Orbit's gum, and that he has a little slot in his heel for. It looks like those shoes that Nike came out with so you could sync them with your iPhone. You had those little tabs that went in the back of it. That's exactly the way it's supposed to work. And so Bond is able to make sure that they know where he is. And so he all of a sudden, bink, pops up on the eastern seaboard of the U.S.
Yep.
Cool. And he comes out of the bathroom wearing this beautiful kind of houndstooth gray suit with the vest. It's a three-piece suit. Looks damn good.
Yep. Not as you said, not a fold in it, even though it was in a suitcase.
And you're just like, Q Branch, oh, you. Oh, Q. And they land in Baltimore, which we frankly see none of. And the next shot we see is him in Kentucky.
Oh, Kentucky.
How do we know it was Kentucky?
Well, station wagons!
They get picked up from the airport by Oddjob and some henchmen in a station wagon, which is wood paneled.
The Goldfinger family station wagon that you had mentioned.
Gone are the fancy, classy cars. Now
the Oryx studmobiles.
Station wagons. Yeah.
And we hear banjo music because the English have us in high regard. Very high regard. Guy Hamilton's like, you know, I saw this documentary called The Dukes of Hazzard. And the Dukes, they always play this
Duke
banjo. Oh, will they ever catch those Duke boys? On America's Most Wanted, those Dukes boys seem to outnumber the police every single time. Oh, my. Oh, Guy Hamilton.
The other way, there are two more ways we know it's Kentucky. First, it's Oryx Stud Farm. So it's horses.
That was hilarious.
And second, fried chicken.
Yep.
Kentucky Fried Chicken. Featured prominently.
And Felix Leiter, my God, he is sitting under a giant, as though he's the head of Big Brother in 1984. Just Colonel Sanders is looking down on the CIA benevolently. It's amazing.
Eyes wide and a smile, and it's kind of creepy.
And it just says, and it just, because again, it's weird because, you know, Bond is always, like you said, pictured in a classy car. He's always by, like, he never has a partner. He's by himself. And then the CIA apparently is in Dragnet. It's just two guys in felt, like, gray flannel suits and, like, gray hats sitting outside of a KFC.
In a Studebaker.
In a Thunderbird.
It was a Thunderbird.
It was a little nice shooting a Studebaker.
But it's still not, like, it's not even...
It's not even a Mustang.
It's nothing. It's not even a Cadillac. Like, I guess, like, the equivalent would be a nice Caddy, but no, it's more like the Ford Mustang we saw, which is great. I'd take that Thunderbird. I'm not... Please. If you're listening.
And you have one and like to give it up, Nick will take it.
I will. Or a granny MP, you know, MP40.
MP40,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But only if it comes with a floral dress. The way Hoover would have wanted. And J. Edgar. I'm sorry, I'm done.
That'd be a good cosplay right there.
Oh, my God. At the next BondCon 2016. I'm the granny.
not to take a step back and slow us down, but can we actually comment about how the henchmen fired their guns a la, like, you know, 1950s westerns?
Like, it was
like, throwing the bullets out of their guns.
Like, it was the 1934 Scarface movie where they're like throwing it from their wrist, like the bullets coming out with whiplash.
It's that extra velocity that you get on the bullet.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my god! And leaning out of the side of whatever car that was, it was just.
It was. I mean, it was shot like a gangster movie. It was like a guy with a Tommy gun outside, and like it was great.
It was
an homage to a lot of different movies as you went through.
Well, and it's funny because this is a little bit early for, you know, the Hong Kong kung fu movie scene, but it's filmed often like it because they're wearing essentially karate gi
denim gis
with
some
these
hatchets,
big yellow
like
belts. and it's still filmed like a triad movie at times, and yet it's, well, we're not to the super racist Bond, but it's coming.
Stay tuned,
keep listening to Mission Briefing. Things are gonna take a turn. But yeah, no, I think this kind of works because when they get to Kentucky, it's just more of the same kind of henchman material. Of course, the difference here is that the CIA is literally standing on the edge of the farm with binoculars and people are like, huh, well, this isn't subtle. They're just trying to get tips on the horses or something. And you're just like, wait, does Goldfinger also do horse racing? Like, apparently, just in everything.
Yeah. He's the stud farm. I mean, may as well.
Yeah, and it's not unusual to have a couple of guys just watching them with binoculars. It's only since Bond was there that Goldfinger says, huh, maybe there's more to these guys.
Yeah,
I think, yeah.
Cracking that code. Like, the fact that he just killed some mafia people didn't raise suspicion, but Bond is
here.
Those
mafiosos were atrocious.
Well, let's get to the mafia.
Okay.
So Bond is in jail. He was taken to the... I guess a ground floor or a basement thing underneath the stables.
Given the dumbest guard I have ever seen.
Where it's rule of threes, right? Because Bond is like eye flirting with this guy's like, hello there. I'm very, oh yes. I'm walking away and forward and away and forward. And
now,
there's an elevator.
I actually thought it was clever.
Oh,
I liked it.
This is Sean Connery doing improv.
Yeah.
That was fantastic. I'm still saying the guard was an idiot.
He was.
Oh, yeah.
It was just so funny. It was just like,
You're not going to expect... Wait, watch this. This is Sean Connery.
Wait, no, guys, I got this.
I got this. I've got this. Cracked this code. Control save nailing this one. And then Vaughn just kind of disappears out of sight and then somehow jumps to the side, climbs up into the rafters, like this little ridge. And the guy's like, the hell is he doing? Opens the door with his gun, and then Bond just essentially falls on top of him, knocks him out cold, takes his handgun.
And starts wandering around.
And wanders around. Because Bond doesn't even think to say, put him on the bed and throw the sheet over him. No, no, he just leaves him on the floor and takes the gun. Again, this is the sloppiest we've seen Bond so far. Little cocky. This is great.
I mean, not to jump forward, because I actually remember reading this book, and I've also read Thunderball, which is coming next. And they actually kind of comment on that, and it was basically going, you know, hey, you've kind of sucked a lot recently in the beginning of the Thunderball.
Well, it's so funny, because, like, if we watch the movies, assuming that Casino Royale reboots the series, this is Bond, like, 5 or 6 major missions in then, you know, like, because, you know, that whole trilogy is supposed to happen before this, right? And so this is his 5th or 6th big mission, and he's cocky. He thinks he's confident, and this time he's really screwing it up. He has to beg for his life in a way that we never would see Daniel Craig. But again, it's continuity. At this point, he's getting sloppy. It's great, right? Mm-hmm. This is Bond in some ways his most human, where he's actually afraid and screwing shit up. But he stumbles into this, God, I don't know.
It's meeting.
Like, it's like he finds this back room. And then we have this cold cut where all of a sudden it cuts to Goldfinger coming in with a bunch of toughs wearing suits playing pool and drinking beer.
Riding ponies. Riding fake toy ponies.
Yeah, it's like a mechanical bucking bull kind of thing. But instead you have to turn a crank.
It was so bizarre. It was full-grown men.
Vaguely homoerotic.
It was.
And then Goldfinger comes in and starts explaining his plan. And the thing is, first, everyone's pissed off because there's East Coast, West Coast gangsters and
North Coast,
but they're
South
not
Coast.
Pissed before Goldfinger walks in. They're all hunky dory with each other when.
Although, no, because there's that one guy who's pacing around and he's like, and everyone's.
He's gonna wear a hole in the floor.
Yeah. Hey, asshole, what the fuck's wrong with you?
Is that foreshadowing?
Hey!
It very well could have been.
And then Goldfinger comes in, and we're this close to hearing, you damn Kraut, where's my money? Because they're all Italian guys who are semi-racist against the German guy. He's like, hey, asshole, you each promised us a million. Goes, but what if tomorrow it was 10 million? And then they're like, what now? My bank, we can go to my banks tomorrow. It's like, it's Sunday, asshole. There's no banks open on Sunday. He goes, but my bank will be. And you're just like, like it's such this weird protracted scene, right?
Yeah.
Sorry, just explain so let me get what's
this,
going on.
Let me get the sequence for the transformation. So, map opens up. Hey, what's this map?
An actual wait. Line from
pool
the movie.
Table. Yeah. Pool table moves. Hey, what's the pool table doing?
Hey, Columbus, I don't read maps. Yeah,
hey, what's the floor?
Put the lights back on, man.
These guys,
I don't know.
I don't feel comfortable in enclosed spaces.
I don't know who decided the writing for these lines, but it was terrible.
Well, and what's worse is this is a movie. I think John brought this up. A lot of people are dubbed here because Goldfinger, the actor who played him, had such a strong accent that they dubbed him. And of course, there's a lot of background noise which would be picked up. And this is the era where everyone's dubbed anyway. But whatever cliche factory these stereotypes came out of, this is the worst.
It was like, bad.
And again, if you told me, I think someone looked this up, almost nothing that's in the States is filmed in the States. So these are English people doing accents that they saw from 1930s James Cagney movie. And that's generous. That's generous, because these are atrocious. Hey, boss!
Yeah, exactly. Use
owe us $1 million in bullion.
My cousin Vinny's gonna come down here.
Oh my God. Two mutes, no.
And then you realize that Felix Leiter in this movie is atrocious, but he still has the most convincing American-ish accent by far, because these guys are just the most cartoonish characters. My God.
That's what happens when you film a movie in England that's set in America. You can only find British people to do your acting for you.
And I mean, but it's the same thing the other way around. When you hire Americans to do, I mean, that's why when you want, if you want Ernesto if you want Ernesto Blofeld to be Austrian, you hire Christoph Waltz. Like, that makes sense. But
like, not like hiring Dick Van Dyke to play.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's what it is. Like, that's how you feel. Like, you really have this, like, hey, yous, guys! And you're just like, no, please.
Please stop.
You could have found an American actor for $10. Yeah. Like, please.
Get someone on the street to talk normally, and it'll be fine.
Yeah, no, it's just get that guy that killed Kennedy or whatever. Yeah. You know, he would have done it.
Which was, what, a year before this movie came out?
Less than that. It was like 8 months. So much so that the VO had to change at one point, apparently. Like, well, no, this is me making an assumption, but they refer to Cape Kennedy, which is what Cape Canaveral became after Kennedy was shot. So this was changed right before, because this movie came out in 64, right after Kennedy was shot. Although they say the president, but they don't say Lyndon Johnson, so you're just like, oh, that's weird. But they didn't fix that. It's not like President Johnson was a surprise by that point. So,
yeah.
Which makes me think that they had to go in and change some things, but not other things. Regardless. So the whole plot is explained to these mafiosi, right? Who wants to try to take a hand at this?
Okay, so basically Goldfinger goes, we're going to go, you know, there's been all these great advances in travel, in science, but nothing great in crime. And so he basically wants to pull off the greatest heist in history. To him, that would be taking on the bank that he calls, basically he calls it a bank, it's Fort Knox. 10,500 tons of gold bullion.
Which is a lot of gold bullion.
Yeah, and so basically he's promising, we're going to just take it all, and I'm just going to give you 10 million when I have it. And, you know, this will be great. You know, you'll get, you know, 10 times what you thought you would, get all these guys on board. And one of them goes, no, this is insane. Give me my money. I'm out of here. And the rest of them are like, no, wait. This guy's got something here. I can't do a bad Italian. I mean, I can do not a great Italian accent, but I can't do that bad.
Yeah, I'm going to say, like, no matter how bad your accent is,
I can't do it. And so the rest of them are like, let's do this. And Goldfinger's like, no, he's fine. I'll give him his money, then I'll come back to talk to you. This seems about fair to what the premise. He walks out with that guy. Those guys are just kind of flouncing around. And everything shuts. And the nerve gas they were going to use to knock out everybody in Fort Knox, the 41,000 people, 41,000 soldiers and then extra people around, goes off in the room, and all of them collapse in a very interesting series of drops.
Well, in case you're curious, in modern money, according to the Apple and the current closing value, that's $365 trillion worth of gold.
We could pay off the national debt with that. Well,
right.
Well, you wouldn't have a national debt because it would be all gold back, wouldn't it?
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the math works out, which makes me think that something's wrong there.
So basically, Solo
billion. 365 billion.
That's okay. More realistic. I was like,
hey, math, I'm so bad. there were a lot of zeros.
And so your Solo gets sent off. Bond is brought up and manages to slip after hearing all of this. Gets caught by Pussy Galore, taken up to see Goldfinger as he's taking Solo out, and Bond manages to stick a tracker and a note in his pocket, thinking, hey, this'll work.
And the CIA will somehow find him, right?
Well, because they're going to start tracking the tracker.
And they'll just pull him over and be like, what are you? Oh, you're not Bond. What does this message say? And it says James Bond to CIA. It's like when someone says they're going to call the Marines in a movie.
Dear military, monsters are coming.
And you're just like, no, this isn't how that works.
Doesn't he have some sort of code he could write it in? Or like,
you would think.
Why doesn't, I mean, at this point, this is the third movie in a row where him and Felix are close. You'd think that he would have something to reach Felix.
Some sort of walkie-talkie?
His own little tracking device just for lighter, mm-hmm. just like an SOS. Anything! But this is, again, this is one of those weird things where you're like, it's the Cold War. You guys are supposed to be allies, but no. The British are just as competitive with the Americans as they are with the Russians somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's so contrived here. Like, anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry. This frustrated me because
it did.
It doesn't make sense because, well, whatever happens at the end we'll get to, but somehow they get a message from Pussy Galore, which we'll get to how weird that is anyway.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, the Bond doesn't get a message to the CIA, which is supposed to give us stress, which means that, again, Bond is on his own. But at the end, somehow they get the message.
And actually, that didn't bother me. It was feasible because we were kept in the dark about what happened with Pussy Galore during that time, and she knew that there were people spying on her.
Yeah.
And that she knew it was because Bond was there.
Yeah, I think...
Yeah, no, because Blofeld said that.
You know, whereas last time, like, for From Russia With Love...
Blofeld said that?
No, Blofeld.
We did.
Goldfinger. They're both kind of right.
You know what would be great, though? I just thinking about it, if Blofeld was angry at Goldfinger because... he wasn't part of the organization, right? Mm. And so Blofeld was the one who was trying just as hard as Bond to undercut Goldfinger, right? To get to the, like, that'd be great if, like, behind the scenes there are other supervillains that are competing with Spectre. That is something we should get in these
that
movies.
Would be
and
fun.
Bond is like Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark, where he's just secondary.
Yeah.
He's just there for the ride.
He feels very secondary sometimes to this because he's not the one that gets the message out. He's not the one that stops the bomb. He's not, like, he has his moment.
It's kind of like with From Russia With Love, where he was very secondary to everything.
But at least
he didn't really do much.
Well, in that one, at least he was helpful for pushing things forward and getting things done. The team in place on the ground, as I was going to try and say that earlier, was, you know, was more helpful because they had more knowledge to work with. Mm-hmm. And Bond was just kind of there as a facilitator of certain actions. This one I felt like... I mean, I literally like this.
Tracking device and being a unit to carry the tracking device from Switzerland to Kentucky, he, up to this point, really hasn't done much. Goldfinger has been able to...
Get the better of him
and just do his normal thing anyway, in spite of Bond.
Well, and
Bond escapes, he's captured immediately, he gets thrown back into jail, he escapes, he gets captured immediately, he gets thrown back into jail.
This time has four guards.
This time with a room full of guards, yeah.
Well, and in fact, to this point... it's almost as though the only thing Bond really does in this situation is slow Goldfinger down, right? Like, to the point where, had he not been there, I mean, he ultimately, of course, convinces Pussy Galore to switch side, which matters, kind of.
Which is the next scene, basically. I mean,
he rapes her. But, like, and I know that's, like, me throwing it out. No. This is the rapiest, rapey scene possible. Here.
Oh, is the door locked, or...?
But, I mean, like, the difference, of course, here is that this movie is, I don't know, like, extended because of, in some ways, Bond is slowing down everything. He's saving the day, but he's saving the day because he's obstructing. And, of course, he convinces Pussy Galore to switch sides by kind of raping her. So we have this scene where Bond has... escaped, right? Like we talked about earlier, he stuck his head up through the bottom of Fort Knox because they have two models of Fort Knox. One is a satellite rendering and one is a 3D rendering because there's apparently a guy who just deals only with Spectre and other bad guys around the world making 3D models of things.
He does a great job.
I mean,
he doesn't get caught. He keeps getting new jobs. I mean...
Yeah. Now, do you need all of Kentucky? No, just around Fort Knox. Now, do you need the roads labeled? No, I know the roads, but I need you to have all of... What about the trees? Do you want trees? Well, I need little trees.
I need all of the trees.
I need little trees, because we need to know what the trees look like. Are they deciduous? I don't know. We need to look. Hey, Bill, can you get a guy on the floor? We need to make sure they're deciduous.
That was a beautiful model. Very intricate.
It was. It was great. And they had little windows so Bond could look through them and we could, like, pan in. And
I mean, that model is at Fort Knox now because it was so good.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's pretty. Like, it really does look great. But ultimately, the whole point of this scene is that Bond is getting the information very slowly. Very slowly. And frankly, for him, it's a journey. It's not for any of us because, again, the way he gets the information out is through a third party. He's just the one getting to the bottom of this. And so when he finds out more and more information about Operation Grand Slam, you know, and eventually Pussy Galore gets him. Oh, we didn't mention this, but there's a gas involved, something called Delta 9. Delta 9.
A nerve gas.
Yeah, I said nerve gas. I just didn't say Delta 9.
No,
so.
I mean, it's not that. The reason we see it is because he kills all the counterparts. He kills all the mafiosi.
It makes the whole scene like, he's like, I'm going to tell you my plan because I just got to tell somebody who doesn't know. And then I'm going to kill you.
That's exactly what it is. It's like, I have this great plan and no one's going to hear about it. I'm going to be so perfect that the press isn't going to get to the bottom of it until it's too late. So I'm going to explain to you step by step. And the best part is, it's not the truth. because there's more to the plot that Bond figures out later.
Yeah.
So this is really a scene only, like, this is something people hate about Bond movies, right? Because it's the
just
most
useless exposition.
But doesn't even tell you the thing. No. It's completely made up because the people who hear it are going to die, A, and then of course B, it's not the plot at the end.
Yeah.
So it's nothing. Mm-hmm. Does he know Bond is listening?
You almost feel like he does. Like, that to a part of it was just kind of like, you know, once again, dicking with Bond. Like,
which would have worked if he could hear it from his cell, but he can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Because by this point, he knows Bond is a secret agent. In fact, he makes that reference. Oh, a license to kill. My henchman has licenses to kill as well.
Well, no, he says, I got your information from one of your counterparts who also happens to have a license to kill.
But like, that's just it. So if he knew Bond could hear, that would be different. Because
it would
then
be.
Maybe he could get the information out wrong. Right?
Yeah.
But this is weird. In fact, it's so weird. It could almost be cut from the movie if Bond didn't need the exposition.
We needed the exposition. We needed to know what the nerve gas did.
Right. And we needed that example. In fact, we could have almost had that, where it was just him telling people, like, showing off the nerve gas. And he goes, and just walked by, like, this will work perfectly for our plot tomorrow when we take over Fort Knox. Like, that. Something. But it's just weird. Right? Then ultimately, he gets captured. And so, Pussy Galore is the one who finds him. So she's taking him outside on the grounds, right as that one mafiosi who said, I just want my money now. I want the £1 million in bullion, or $1 million in bullion now, not the $10 million tomorrow.
Which, if one brick is 5,000, how did $1 million of bullion fit in a suitcase?
Science.
That's a good point.
Yeah, no. Because
you need 2,000 bricks?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah.
In one trunk?
Maybe it was like some bricks and then a check or something. I don't know.
And also, as a side, to that point, when the car gets crushed into a cube, which we should get to, there's no way that mile of solid bullion fits.
No.
No. No.
Are you mathing as hard as you can?
I got this. Okay.
Someone was doing some long division, gentlemen.
So that'd be about 200 bars. So about 16 pounds of bars. It's a lot.
But that would have been great if whatever that car was, because it wasn't anything we'd seen before. So whatever it was, an old Buick, I think they said, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Like a Buick's driving off with the rear axle half bent as it's
and
dragging.
Then you have Oddjob carry it out and then hand it to the guy and he just drops it.
Yeah. And then, like, you see sparks coming off the muffler as it's dragging on the axle.
1.5 tons in the back of that car of pure gold just dropped right there, if I'm doing my math.
Which gets rendered into a cube, a yard by a yard by a yard, that Oddjob effectively picks up with his bare hand because he's Oddjob and apparently he's infinitely strong.
Of
he's
course.
A cyborganizer.
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys got it. The mafiosi gets taken to his death.
So let's just jump to where I guess Bond and Goldfinger are having a little chat with Mint Juleps, I guess. Like, kind of go.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so Pussy Galore and him are walking along because I found Mr. Bond on the ground. He goes, it's too beautiful of a day to be inside. And so they go out and have Mint Julep, and Bond knows what kind of whiskey he wants in a Mint Julep because he's Bond and he's had every drink around the world ever. Mm-hmm. He ate the worm at the bottom of the tequila. He's been there. We've got that. Fine. And at this point, Goldfinger's explaining the rest of his plot. And Bond's like, oh no, there's more to it than that. You want to not only, you don't want to take the gold. He goes, because I've done the math. I've done the math, Goldfinger. It would take 60 men, like 12 days or something.
It was 10,500, was it 10,500 tons of gold.
Yeah.
I mean, we just talked about how ridiculous $1 million was just right there.
And within 24 hours, every single person in the U.S. military is going to be bearing down on Fort Knox.
No, within 2 hours, he said.
Within 2 hours.
How are you going to do this? You can't possibly get all that gold out.
And then Bond goes,
you're not going to get it out.
Yeah, and he goes, you're going to destroy it. He goes, yes. This one person was a nuclear physicist because I've got a nuclear weapon. Ultimately, the whole point is he's going to nuke the gold, devaluing it. So, well,
cadmium
irradiated.
Irradiated. So ultimately, his gold will be worth whatever, infinitely as much. Like, half
ten
the gold reserves.
Well, you've just removed $15 billion worth of gold from the world market.
And half the Western gold reserve.
Yeah,
right?
yeah exactly.
And so ultimately, all the gold that he owns will be worth that much more. Mm-hmm. And so he'll become wealthy. It's this wonderful plan where he kills off all the mafia by taking their gold, because apparently the mafia dealt in gold. And this, not again, we talked about it at the top. This Nazi guy has taken all the world's gold. It's this wonderful throwback plot to the Cold War, which again, Ian Fleming, World War II spy. This is the kind of stuff they were worried about.
Yeah.
And Bond cracks this code and just goes, actually, this is a brilliant plan. As though he's like, if only I could do the same thing with liquor.
Well, no, and Goldfinger's actually kind of impressed. He's like, you did figure it out. And then he's like, and he said, and if somehow you do manage to stop me, just think about this. You know, one of these bombs going off in, and he lists off.
Well, no, he goes, you know, the bomb is in the country. The Americans will have found it by now. He goes, oh, no, because if they did, it could go off literally anywhere. It could go off in Baltimore or at Cape Kennedy.
Or the
White House.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you're just like, oh, shit. This is really like the Red Scare. This is McCarthyism. Like, mm-hmm. literally the nukes could be anywhere. Mm-hmm. And this is, in some ways, again, this makes it the most Cold War Bond we've had.
And yet this is the least political Bond we've ever had.
Yes.
It's not the Russians. It's not the U.S. It's not even the British intelligence. It's a smuggler.
It's the most topical to today, right?
Well, yeah.
Because, like, you know, this is like Lord of War shit, where, like, the Cold War has ended, but people just ended up with the nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. This is those...
Yeah, those weapons didn't go away.
Yeah, and that's what makes it the scarier. This, in some ways, like, yeah, Goldfinger is a cartoon, but the idea that nukes are just around? Yeah, that's the thing we worry about now. Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump wanted to. Never mind. That's too.
No, we're done.
but it was almost Goldfinger telling Bond that it's better you don't mess around with my plans, because what's a city worth of irradiated people and buildings to gold? Right, I get richer. No one gets hurt, or you get no one, or you get this thing going off in Times Square.
Right. Yeah. And then it's important because this is Bond at his weakest as far as in control of what's going on. But at the same time, it's real, right? Like, this is the kind of thing that I guess they actually dealt with in some ways. Like, this is crazy.
Existential crisis.
Yeah. Well, and so basically, you know, Goldfinger gives his little spiel, and then Pussy Galore comes over after he had asked her to dress in something a little more comfortable.
Yeah.
Which was...
And then you have this weird scene where she's...
touching scene, yeah.
And she is not at all into that. She's like, I'm here for the money. Like, literally, I'm your henchwoman.
Yeah.
Which is the second time we've had women who have been employed by Goldfinger specifically say, I don't want him touching me.
Well, have you seen that tub of lard? I mean,
well, yeah. But usually power attracts a certain type of woman.
But apparently not with him.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, and it's weird because she is so... Well, we talked about this. Like, Ian Fleming has a thing about lesbian types. And in the book, she's a lesbian. And, like, Bond, through the power of boners, can fix that. Because Ian Fleming had a real problem with that kind of thing. Here, it's a little bit protracted. It's kind of on the nose. And it's not said. But, frankly, we were talking about this when we were watching the movie. If you told me Goldfinger was gay, it would make sense. Because the woman at the top, Jill... is not into him. In fact, she says, he just pays me for appearances. She's essentially a beard. And in a Freudian way, the first thing he wants to do is hit Bond in the genitals with the laser. And the women, of course, are all lesbians. They're not interested in him. And, like, it's this very weird sexual politics here, because Bond sleeps with a woman or two, thanks to him having sex with Pussy Galore anyway, in a very rapey scene. But it's one of these weird movies where Bond doesn't even matter that Bond doesn't have a lot of sex, but none of the women are interested in him. Mm-hmm. It's very on the surface that they're like, meh.
Yeah, why not? Like, you know, I got nothing better to do. Like,
yeah, and he's like, you know, I'm interesting. They're like, no, you're not. I mean, Bond struck out as much as this movie as I did in high school.
So she takes him away after the plot is unveiled. Pussy Galore is supposed to take him back, I guess, to his jail cell.
Or just walk him along the grounds, basically, just to make him look like things are fine for the CIA.
Right, for the CIA, yeah. They stop at a barn.
And
he walks in, and they tussle.
Go for a roll in the hay.
After some struggle, which is weird.
Some inappropriate struggle.
Some judo.
And it was one of the few times we were all uncomfortable with him scoring. And it was
uncomfortable.
It's uncomfortable, yeah.
It was very uncomfortable.
And Felix goes, that's my Bond. And you're just like, eee. he hasn't even wingmanned. He's just watched Bond a lot, and you're just like, no, this is all bad. This
he lives
is all
vicariously yeah. through Bond. It's yeah, very
this
is, wrong.
Yeah. So much. Bond comes to the next day or whatever, and the plot is underway. He's being taken to Fort Knox because the idea is that he is going to die when the bomb goes off, etc.
Yeah.
And so far, as far as we see, the plot is going off without a hitch.
The planes go by overhead.
Yeah, a Pussy Galore's Flying Circus, which is a series of fembots, as we pointed out. With matching jumpsuits, are flying these prop planes, or these trick planes, essentially, with gas canisters underneath. They're gassing people with Delta 9. And as they fly overhead, people are dropping to the ground. They use dynamite to blow up the gates, the electrified gates outside of Fort Knox. And they use the industrial laser we were introduced to earlier to cut through the exterior doors. And they use this weird hacking device to hack open the vault door. So they get into the gold vault with Bond, who is handcuffed at first to Ajab. Second, they transfer him to be attached to the nuclear bomb. Mm-hmm. To blow up inside the gold vault, which we see is filled with this kind of industrial elevator and just stacks of gold behind metal bars on either side. Yeah, I'm trying to hurry up through this because we've been going forever.
But then we're introduced to the trick that as soon as they set the bomb, I guess the radiation or something set something off. The CIA are there. Felix is just outside the gates. He's got a little machine that starts going haywire. He's like, all right, everybody get up. Let's go. All the military guys, they jump to their feet, grab their guns, and they go in charging. Cavalry has arrived.
And this is another thing that happens in Bond later movies, because in Thunderball and in Moonraker and in Never Say Never Again and things like that, you have the army versus the enemy's army, right?
Yeah.
And that's what this is. And, I mean, hell, even in the gypsy scene in From Russia with Love, you have these, like, two battles, and Bond is in between trying to get shit done. But, again, in this movie, he's at his least competent, almost. Like, he's barely able to even help in the battle. And I keep wanting to say Ernesto Goldfinger. It's not. It's just Goldfinger. Goldfinger strips off his jumpsuit thing and underneath has this colonel's uniform for the U.S. military.
Yep.
And he escapes.
He escapes. He's like, oh no, I'm just here to help them. And he pulls out a handgun and is shooting henchmen.
Is that solid gold? Like the gold-plated handgun?
Yeah, it's a gold-plated Colt 45.
Dead giveaway. You don't take orders from that person.
Especially since he has a German accent.
Yeah.
Red flags.
No, it reminds me of a movie that came out a few years later, Dr. Strangelove, where the guy's just like, Mein Führer! And he's talking to the president. He's like, Mein General, I'm here to help you. And you're just like, no, you're not. No, you're not. No,
you can't possibly know.
So Bond is stuck in, while this is all going on, Bond is stuck in the vault with Oddjob and the bomb.
Yeah.
Bond is trying to get away from the bomb and somehow, I guess, kill Oddjob.
And and the one henchman who's just like one of the Cuban revolutionary force who Ajab ends up throwing down six stories onto a metal bar and crushing him.
And the clang was actually kind of cringe-inducing. You're like, oh.
Yeah, no, he hit solid something
it
at the bottom
squick.
Of that hill.
It was
it was great cinematography in there that all the scenes inside the vault are just dead quiet.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've got the clang of the bars, you've got the electricity later.
There's no calamity from outside.
No calamity. Footsteps running down, and you've got the tick of the timer on the bomb.
Which is the longest 300 seconds, may I add.
Yeah.
Well, and it's great because so much through this movie, we get the Bond theme a few times, especially this time properly cued when Bond is doing good things, not like, say, walking through a hotel. And you also have a secondary hit from, you know, Goldfinger. But here, it's utter silence in the right way. Because, you know, Oddjob doesn't speak, and he's a big, powerful wrestler-type body frame. Bond, who's angular but can't beat this guy. You know, Oddjob is stronger than him. And so, like you said, all you hear are steps on steel staircases and concrete floors, and that makes it all the creepier of us. It's a more powerful scene because Bond is being thrown around into walls and you hear thuds. Like, there's no music. It's just pain. Ultimately, after that guy gets thrown to the ground, Bond is able to uncuff himself from the nuclear weapon.
For this fight, like, just, you know, before he, you know, uncuffs him from the nuclear weapon, goes to this fight with Oddjob. And it's actually kind of interesting because one of the film notes is that in this fight, I can't remember the actor's name who plays Oddjob. He doesn't do much else besides this except maybe replay Oddjob a couple times in a few other movies.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this is a Japanese-American, he's born in Hawaii, a wrestler. He actually hurt Sean Connery, and they had to delay filming for a while, like, by accident in this fight scene.
Yeah. Like, well, I mean, because you could tell they're throwing each other around, and it's a room without padding. Like, there's nowhere to hide it. And, like, Bond will pick up something, like a wooden plank, which shouldn't be where they are, but it is, and he breaks it over this guy, because this guy is just huge. And at one point, ultimately, Oddjob throws his hat. Bond is able to duck, pick up the hat, throws it, misses Oddjob, but it sticks in this metal wall. And Bond is able to electrocute him with his live wire that falls on the ground, which, frankly, looking at the cut of the scene, these are all practical effects. So that wire was sparking and smoking, and Bond literally lands on it. Mm-hmm. And so he also probably hurt himself there, because you don't see Bond's stunt double much. You see him occasionally, but not much
not
here.
Not much, no.
Connery in that beautiful hairpiece in this one just is able to hold on there. But with Oddjob dead, Bond has to try to fix the weapon. And so Gold, which just appears out of nowhere in bar form, Bond is trying to crack open.
He grabs it.
From where?
Under the grates.
Okay, so he reaches to the grates, grabs some gold bars, and is trying to break this lock on this nuclear weapon, which they've locked, because, you know, you just have to be sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's desperately trying to fix it. Stop it. Turn it off. Whatever. Anything. He's tugging on wires. There's little things that are spinning that look like, I don't know, little, like, hypnotic things. And he's grabbing them to see if he can stop them from spinning. Bond has no idea what the hell is going on. And meanwhile, the U.S. military and the CIA are running down the stairs to try to stop him, running down the stairs to try to fix it. No one thinks to shout, hey, there's a switch. Which, there's a switch.
Good thing they locked it, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because there's literally a switch. And so Bond is, like, the scene starts, there's still somehow 56 seconds left, and people are running down the stairs trying to get to Bond, get to Bond, get to Bond, get to Bond. And it stops. But what time does it happen to stop at?
Double hello, seven.
Oh, seven.
It's one of the most
cheesy
protracted and again, you wonder where someone like Roger Moore comes from, and like how you go from someone as serious as Dr. No to Roger Moore. It's those things right there. They're like, that was the best joke. The audience loved that one. And you're just like,
let's
freaking?
Just make a whole movie filled with jokes like that. And you're like, please, God.
Yeah, Roger Moore will return and live and let die. And that's all that is.
Yeah.
Which isn't a bad movie. It's just that you realize we're done with kind of gritty Bond. Mm-hmm. Let's have silly Bond. Mm-hmm. Silly Bond. Go ahead.
So the day is saved. The gold is safe. Okay, Goldfinger got away. But that's okay.
We're right behind him.
But here's where we find, I guess it was Felix came in, mm-hmm. and Bond is just kind of giving him a quizzical look. How are you alive?
Yeah.
And Felix says, well, we got a call from Pussy Galore this morning who warned us and switched out the gas canisters with something.
So we just were nothing. Just probably like CO2 or something. Yeah.
We were able to get the jump on him. So Pussy is good. And
good night, everybody.
Yeah.
And so they end up at this nearby airbase near Fort Knox, and he's like, well, Mr. Bond, I guess you just have to have dinner or lunch with the president. He's like, with the president? What would we talk about? He goes, I guess alcohol.
Something.
And so he goes up onto this Piper Cub, Piper Chessmaster, as we see. And it turns out that the actual crew has been knocked out by and taped up with tape, and they've been hogtied by Goldfinger somehow and Pussy
Galore.
And they've taken this plane. And so Bond wrestling with Goldfinger, who comes out still in military uniform with his gold-plated Colt 45.
Yep.
And they start fighting over the gun, and then all of a sudden it turns into a cartoon as Goldfinger, who is, like, I guess, tied up Matrix style. And, well, he fires the gun. It blows out a window. Bond is able to hold on to the edge of a sofa thing. And Goldfinger ends up getting sucked out of a plane window as he turns into a cartoon character and gets sucked out as a clip art.
I felt it was very Ghostbusters-y. Like, replace the window with a ghost trap.
Right.
And, you know, Goldfinger's one of the ghosts, and he, like, hovers in the air.
No, I was going to say, like, if you told me that Ivan Reichman based it on that, I'd believe it because the whole color palette changes and Blofeld turns about 50 shades grayer. and then literally is in a weird kind of pseudo like propped up position, like he's floating. And then they just move that clip art around and suck him out the window without explaining anything. And then Pussy Galore, who's the pilot, drops below 10,000 feet so the pressure stabilizes, but they're still crashing.
Which I don't get. That didn't make sense to me. A, why is she the pilot and why is she still working with Blofeld?
Considering he...
Yeah.
Goldfinger.
Oh, God damn it. Goldfinger.
But considering he knows at this point that she is the bad...
That really bothered me.
He made a comment about it.
Yeah, he goes, I'll take care of her later. And you're like...
Well, why?
What?
What? She's flying. She could be flying it to, you know, CIA jail right now. You don't know.
CIA jail, flying to Gitmo.
Yeah,
that's what I was thinking.
Well, he was headed to Cuba.
Ironic, right? But ultimately, they crash land, and it's funny because we see radar, like old style radar, where there's just this blinking dot kind of moving across the street. Then all of a sudden, there's a smaller dot as they apparently eject.
I feel that ending was kind of hacked together. Because, like, all of the CIA is now at a control tower at an airport.
Well, because Felix Leiter runs into the back room and says, hey, these guys are tied up. Oh, no. Bond. Can you imagine telling President that, I'm sorry, I was late. I was nailing some chick outside of Kentucky. We've all been to Kentucky, son. Like, I don't know. It's just weird. Anyway, so it closes with them wrapped in a parachute. And this is the...
She likes him now.
And she likes him now, even though he raped her the first time, I guess, whatever. Although she became a good guy, kind of.
Kind of.
And, scene. So, we're three Bonds in. How do you guys think this one held up?
I loved it.
Yeah, it was very fun.
It was very... it was enjoyable to watch. Mm-hmm. It moved
good
a
pacing,
lot.
Good yeah. pacing.
You know, frankly... I was talking to John about this in the car. There are two kinds of Bond movies now. There's ones who try to emulate Goldfinger and those who try to emulate From Russia with Love, wherein, you know, there's, you know, what's the main point? Bond's character development or some some giant Bond supervillain. This is your archetype for a supervillain, right? This is what it is. And everyone who wants a supervillain type, hell, Tomorrow Never Dies even. Like, this is who they're basing it off of. If you want Bond to grow as a character, Casino Royale style even, you want From Russia with Love. I would say, of the ones we've watched so far, this is the one you show to anyone. Because From Russia to Love, with Love, you like if you're a Bond fan because it's dark, it's weird, it's complicated. This one, you throw in front of anyone, they're like, oh, I get this. I know what this is. Mm-hmm. There's a laser pointing at a man's crotch and he's terrified. I'm there, man.
Well, this is the one where it doesn't matter what age you are. You will find something to like out of this. It's got action. It's got spy stuff. It's got decent plot. It's got, I guess for the time, decent special effects. It had everything.
It starts the, vodka martini shake. I mean, I don't know. It's just this series of classic, the things that become well-known for being Bond. It's not that they started here, but it's almost kind of like they got cemented here.
Well, and it's even Bond gets quips in the way that we expect him to. Like, he's making out with that woman at the beginning, right? And, you know, she's an erotic dancer, effectively. And she's trying to grab around him and, like, hits her hand on the gun. And she's like, why do you always wear that thing? He goes, well, I guess I have an inferiority complex. And you're just like, that is such a Bond line. You know what I mean? Like, because it's not just a quip. It's like pseudo Freud. It's like it's so self aware that you're like, oh, Bond gets it. Well, he's just a degenerate alcoholic.
Well, when the mafioso gets, you know, his car gets canned, he goes, well, I guess he did have a pressing engagement.
Yeah.
Right? That's what it is. It's Bond getting it now. Mm-hmm. This is the Bond we want. And again, anyone who's seen Austin Powers, even the new Dark Knight, you know, like trilogy, whatever, like hell, even the Bourne movies. This is the spy movie they want to be seeing because they want more of the joke. This is filled with jokes. This has an actual plot. Mm-hmm. This has an actual super villain. Like he's a villain. Like he's he's German, but he's the gentleman English type where he's like, I'm going to offer you a drink because this is what you do when you sit down with someone, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and it's an afternoon drink, so it's not straight liquor. It's a cocktail. Like there are rules in this world that you understand, where the men are wearing three-piece suits, the women get objectified until it's men's talk. You go. right? I think this is great. I think this is like, and it's cliched to like Goldfinger, and it's maybe not even the best movie, but it's the best Bond movie.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a good reason why everyone likes this movie.
It's kind of hard to call this cliche because it's the one that it become cliched because everyone else references something that's in it. It's not cliche. It's what came after it that
the cliches are based on it.
Yeah.
And every aspect of Bond in this movie, if you want to make a hero movie, you take aspects of Bond here. Do you want the hero type that's strong? Well, then you can get Die Hard, but you're still taking aspects of Bond. Do you want the... Hell, even Austin Powers, the plot is Dr. No, but Bond in this is much more Bond.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, that's what it is. However, we are out of time. In 2 weeks, Mission Briefing will return with Thunderball. Thanks, guys!
Mission Briefing and Myopia Defender Childhood are produced by Dude Letter Podcasting. It's hosted and edited by Nick Hoffman. Our graphic designer is Scott Miller. The theme song is sampled from Monty Norman's James Bond theme. Questions and comments? Please visit myopiapodcast.com/missionbriefing or contact us through myopiamissionbriefing@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter @missionbriefing and @myopiapodcast. And find us on Facebook, Stitcher, and iTunes. And while you're on iTunes, please rate and review our podcast. Want to help us out? Go to myopiapodcast.com/Amazon and purchase stuff like normal. Myopia and Mission Briefing get a piece of the action. James Bond will return in Thunderball.
His lies can't disguise what you feel.
But in the book, seriously, like in the next, like Q forces, like, you know, Q's going on this health kick, but he's commenting on Bond. Like, it comes up in the novel a couple times, going and sends him to a health club to like cleanse himself and get in better shape because he's kind of let himself go.
Well, I mean, again, even Felix gets that line where he's like, "We ordered liquor for three," and he goes, "Who else is flying with me?" No, it's just you.
Golden words he will pour in your ear.